tomorrow's the big showdown in Montreal. That's probably the biggest fight of my whole life. This great story I've been living for the last 15 years to come to an end.
I talked to Vince, and he goes, you have to lose to Sean in Montreal.
I can't do that. I can't. I can't do it. I can't. I described it to Vince, I just assume blow my brains out would be the same, about the same, what you're asking me to do. And from a character standpoint, that's what I would be doing. I would be taking Bret the Hitman Hart, would blow his brains out. When people say wrestling, you know, they talk about wrestling not being real. It's far more real than people think.
Hello, and welcome to episode 81 of the New Generation Project podcast, where we have well and truly left the heroes of Hulkamania in the dust and are hurtling towards the advent of Attitude. Today, we conclude our coverage of Survivor Series 1997 and the Montreal Screwjob, and say goodbye to someone who has been with us since the beginning of the show. It's finally farewell to Bret the Hitman Hart, as we take a look at the documentary chronicling a year in Bret's life, It's Wrestling with Shadows. My name is Stuart Brooks, and I'm joined today, as ever, by our very own big fella, Paul Scrivens.
Hello.
And, well, I guess, medium fella, Adam Wykes.
Most of my t-shirts are in a medium size.
Mine aren't. Mine come in big fella.
Is that a special size you've had made by Giacomo or something?
So if it's good enough for Freddie Flintoff.
How are you both doing?
Not too bad, I think. You know, I've had a bit of time off. But I've had very disrupted sleep.
Have you?
Yeah, I have, yeah. Our neighbours have been making a bloody racket at 3 o'clock in the morning all week.
We've got some new neighbours, and yeah, it's not good.
Which side? That side or the other side?
This side.
That side?
Yeah, this side. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's starting to get to me now, actually.
Young, old?
Younger, I think.
Younger.
Yeah.
Ironically, the last tenants next door were students, and they were quieter than these people who clearly aren't students.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe students get a bit of a bad rep.
So maybe with these, like, housewarming, do you think, or...?
No, I think it's just general noise. They actually woke me up for the first time last night, so I'm now also angry about it. Before, I was not fussed.
Do you want me to sing?
That maybe they've heard you sing, and it's retaliation.
Okay.
How about you, Paul? How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, pretty good, pretty good. It's been quite some time since we recorded, because we sort of surreptitiously recorded before WrestleMania, so yeah. It's been a good 3 weeks since we've all been sat in a room together.
And you've had a bit of a trip.
I have had a bit of a trip.
Where'd you go?
We'll discuss that somewhere else.
Okay.
Before we get going today, I need to say thank you for a few things. Firstly, since we last recorded, we have hit a total of 1 million downloads.
Holy shit.
Which is quite... frankly staggering, and the very concept that would ever happen is still quite surreal to me. So thank you to every single person who has listened over the last 3.5 years.
Thank you.
I think before we actually started doing it, we were wondering if it would ever reach one.
Well, I presumed we thought we had 3 at least.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'll just
actually, you two. Probably wouldn't
have bothered, I don't know. But 1 million, that's amazing.
It's a big number.
Any fun facts about the number 1 million?
Yeah, there is.
Secondly, I just want to say thanks to everyone who has given us positive feedback for our coverage of the Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels match in Montreal last episode. I'm not exaggerating when I say that for me it's been something of a white whale, and I was definitely apprehensive to cover it as it's so well covered as a topic, and I wasn't sure whether we could add anything new or provide any kind of different perspective. But the response you guys and girls have given has been incredible and kind of eased a lot of my fears and concerns about what we might produce. So thank you for that also.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Like I said at the time, it was a bit of an education, really.
Yeah, so I don't think me and Paul perhaps had the same apprehensions as you did, because we didn't know an awful lot of that stuff. So it was...
most of the pressure on you, to
be fair. Yeah, it was informative for us, but I would say that what you did was you consolidated together loads and loads of different sources, I think, and that's what was really good about it.
Yeah, you saved literally dozens of hours of work and put it into, like, a nice pellet of... 4 hours of wrestling podcast.
Is pellet the correct word?
Were you thinking of owls?
I was, yeah. How did you know?
Just a hunch.
Yeah.
And finally, I need to say thank you to both of you.
Oh, thank you.
Since we last recorded, it was my birthday, and you both bought me some rather excellent presents when I got back from America, so thank you very much.
Well, welcome. I actually bought them for you before you went to America. I was well prepared.
I think I probably ordered them just before your birthday, but they arrived well after, but I kind of knew I wouldn't see you.
So it all worked out all right?
Yeah.
I want to make special mention of the Michinoku Pro Blu-ray Volume 2 from Rudo Reels. It has some really great stuff on it. Tons of Taka Michinoku, Paul, so...
Thanks.
Loads of Dick Togo as well. You'd
yeah,
love it.
Loads of Dick Togo. I've learned that when he hits you with a senton, like, that's it, game over.
I've seen a gif of that and it looks fearsome.
Yeah, and that was from like this week as well. Like,
what?
Yeah, there's one doing the rounds on YouTube.
He's still putting people down.
Yeah, he's still knocking about. He did retire a few years ago, but has obviously come back. Special mention, though, there is a match on the first disc between Taka and my personal favourite, Gran Naniwa, which sadly doesn't seem to be on either YouTube or Daily Motion, but is an absolute cracker, like 20-minute stormer. So you may have to pick up the disc if you want to see it. Like I say, rudoreels.com is the place to get all of this stuff. The intriguing Hakushi versus Undertaker match is on there also.
Have you watched that?
Yes, I have. I did get to it yesterday. Sadly, the disc version of it has the entrances cut out, which kind of... take some of the story out of the match, but there is a version on YouTube that has the entrances. So at some point, I'd like to cover it if we get the chance.
Is there something interesting about the entrances?
Hakushi's dead.
Of course he is, yes.
Yeah, and he's like a zombie, and he gets brought back to life to fight The Undertaker.
I like that.
You know what? If I was freshly resurrected, fighting The Undertaker would be the last thing I wanted to do.
In addition to the release of this episode, if you want to hear our full analysis of WrestleMania 33, as I alluded to earlier when you tried to get me to open up about my holiday, and the week of activities that surrounded it, then head on over to our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/newgenpodcast to find our review, posted exclusively there. We talk Orlando, basketball, NXT, WrestleMania, Hall of Fame, Monday Night Raw, and much more, and compare my live experience to what Adam and Paul thought of the show when they watched it on the Monday evening. While you're there, there's a ton of other audio that's not available on our regular iTunes feed, so why not have a scroll through the content there in case you've missed anything?
Yeah, and just listen to all the episodes again. Let's go for the next million now.
Okay.
While I thought Adam and Paul would be watching WrestleMania 33 together, I didn't know for certain until I got back home and there was a dead giveaway in our house. Therefore, this week's challenge to you, the audience, was to guess exactly how I knew Paul had been in our house. The following are our favourite suggestions. Drew Mitchell, your DVDs were strewn about your living room, loose, and not in their cases.
That's a very Scribbins-esque thing, isn't it?
That is how I operate, and that is the polar opposite to how you operate.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be like a real odd couple sitcom if we lived together.
It would be, because you do have the most immaculate collection of... DVDs, mainly wrestling, must be said. Wonderfully ordered. I'm very impressed.
But, Thank you. Well, I won't be able to find anything otherwise.
So you like the way that he does it? Is it that you can't be bothered to do it yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
Mainly, yeah. As Mark Mirror once said, I'm a busy man.
Stephen Downton, you found Haribo down all of your furniture.
Now, that is something that happens on a regular basis in this house.
Mm.
Is it just that you sort of throw a bunch of them at your mouth and there's... fallout?
It's most usually when I throw them at somebody else.
Oh, okay.
Often your mouth, for example. Richard Query. Paul accidentally set your house on fire and couldn't work out which fire extinguisher to use to put the blaze out. In the end, he went with all of them, and now your kitchen is covered in foam.
What is it with you and Richard Query and fire extinguishers?
I think we've taken our relationship to the next level, and that level is fire extinguishers.
Matt Lewinsky, your champions on WWE 2K17 were the IRS, Rad Radford, and the Heavenly Bodies.
Can you get the Heavenly Bodies in any games? Because if we can, I want to play as Jimmy Del Rey.
I don't think they've ever been in any wrestling game.
Wow.
There's an oversight.
Well, maybe someone on the community's created them and you can download them.
That is a job for somebody to do.
Chris Hopkins, Bend It Like Beckham was still in the DVD player. The other films have not been touched.
Could happen.
Now, that was a suggestion that came up. Short of Haribo, which I think was top, anything related to Haribo, I think Bend It Like Beckham was second on the most suggested.
Joey Terreri, there was a love letter to Richard Query on your table. And as recently admitted, we've taken our relationship to the next level.
It was an instructional manual for fire extinguishers.
Yes.
David Nichols, you can't say why you knew. You just Michinoku, he was there.
Harry Green. There was a strong smell of pigeon and bacon. That's unlikely to happen, because although Paul finds other foods interesting and has great stories about them, I think he rarely cooks them.
I've got some duck in my freezer, which I bought probably about 2 months ago, thinking, you know what, I've had duck a couple of times and I really like it. And yeah, I've not cooked it.
Are you going to cook it with bacon?
You know what, there's probably worse things to cook duck with.
Oh, yeah, yeah, duck and bacon.
I don't think I've ever had it, but I'd be willing to try it.
Have you not had duck? Duck is very
no,
nice.
No, I've eaten duck, just not with bacon.
I reckon duck wrapped in bacon would work.
Yeah?
Stick an orange in it, it's fine. Chocolate orange. H. Singh Devgon. Paul was a bit bored, so he dismantled your Corby trouser press. And he couldn't put it back together. He also left a note asking whether it'd show up on his bill. Very good.
Dominic Schenderlaws. You found a handwritten letter to Nigel Mansell begging him to regrow and keep his moustache. Is that what your letter to him said?
No, my letter said, please come to my birthday party. it's at the local village hall. I know you've not got a Grand Prix on that weekend.
I have to ask, did he come?
No, he had a pro celebrity golf tournament, or so he said.
Gary Bacon. Your DVD copy of The Road had been destroyed.
Could also happen.
Adam's got a special steelbook version of that. You best not destroy that.
No, I've not. I gave it to Scribbins as a present, didn't I?
Yeah. I thought you kept it in the end.
No, I thought it'd be funnier to give it to him. Have you watched it?
Yeah. No. Mitchell Orwell. He got chocolate mousse on the valance. A skirt thing round the side of the bed.
Alex La Barbera. He was still there when you got home.
John Neve. You returned home to find Scribbins with his foot pierced on a spike at the garden gate after swallowing a load of anthrax and letting off in Adam's bedroom. All he had to say was, "Ooh, did you have a good time?"
What? What's the whole thing about the anthrax?
That's in Partridge, isn't it? Isn't that one of the excuses that he gives to the hotel?
Oh, yeah, it might be, yeah. Yeah. No,
is that a Partridge joke you didn't get?
I've been out-partridged, as it's known. Alex Queller. You came home to find a matchbox filled to the brim with dead house flies.
I later agreed to marry him.
Yeah. As many of you might know from earlier episodes, that's one of my courting tactics.
You only did it the once, right?
But 100% success rate.
Yeah. If anything, I've got a foolproof plan, guys. Let me know when you find a girl you like. I'll find the flies. Bring your own matchbox.
Carl Grice. There was an RAC man tied up in your wardrobe. Was it the RAC you called out last time?
Green flag.
Okay, green flag man, yeah. Tied up in your wardrobe.
Stu Robinson. An abandoned microwave was in the living room.
Again, something that did happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was a few, I think, microwave ones.
There was one that read as a script between me and you, and I said, Adam, have we always had two microwaves? And they then had you shouting Scribbins and presumably waving your fist in the air.
Yeah.
That would happen. Although today you've brought round a defunct or a faulty amplifier, haven't you?
Yeah, it's a Marshall JCM 2000 DSL 401.
But that was done with my blessing because I'm going to try and help fix it for him.
Yeah, I think one of the valves has gone. Yeah.
It's currently functioning as a laptop holder.
Well, I was saying to Adam earlier.
An Easter egg plinth.
Yeah. You need an Easter egg plinth. You don't need half to put when it comes to Easter. but it fit really nicely in your fireplace.
It would do.
So would a fire. Anton Oliveira. He left a lovely note detailing how he values your friendship.
That didn't happen.
It'd be nice if it did, though.
It would have been nice if it did.
I left it under your pillow.
Yeah. David Light. There were large holes in the skirting board. Oh, wait, that's how you know a mouse is there.
B2 Polonen. The podcasting table had the distinct grease marks of a Scribbins special. I'm guessing he means the McDonald's order.
The Big Mac and cheeseburger. Although last time we recorded, Adam took the liberty of deciding to order a pizza for Paul instead of a cheeseburger and a large cheesy chips, and the lack of gratitude was obvious. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I've just bought you dinner. Oh, thanks. It was that type of thing.
You know when you build yourself up for one thing?
Every now and again, have you noticed, I don't know if they tag you in this, but every now and again I will get someone on Twitter go, oh, I've just been to McDonald's, ordered a Scriven special. I'm not sure if they asked for it by name at the counter or if they just ordered the two things separately.
They need to put it as a default on the like new ordering things that they've got.
On like the POS system, yeah. They have like Scriven special, one button, job yeah. done.
Bam.
Loads of people would order it thinking it was some new meal rather than just an existing large meal with an extra cheeseburger.
I've never heard of a Scrivens. What sort of animal's that?
Scrivens sauce.
Scott Cavaliero. He left two Haribo that were great representations of the American males. He just left them on the table, though, because they wouldn't fit in the bag well.
Very good.
Very He's done good. Well to shoehorn that in there.
Yeah. I've got to say, one of the more difficult American males
references. Yeah.
Dave Gill. You found an unwashed mug smelling suspiciously of imitation Lemsip. When was that from?
We've talked about imitation Lemsip before. Oh. Yeah. Mm. James Courtshaw. You found the eyes scratched out on a glossy 8x10. Of Rick the Model Martell.
Sadly, I don't think we have any glossy 8x10s of Rick the Model Martell knocking around anywhere.
Do we have any glossy 8x10s of anyone?
I think we have ones of MVP and Maria that time we went and met them.
Well, no, what I found the other day, you know when we went to that Noah show?
Oh.
And we got those signed bits of like Brian and Jay Briscoe and people like that. I've got those.
Yeah, I think I've still got those somewhere as well. We have got 8x10s, it turns
out.
There
you go, but not of Rick the Model Martell.
Chili Morrison, and I think we now have a new record holder for the most likes on a single comment on one of these. He rearranged your shoes so that all the heels were facing each other.
That is untoppable. Because it is short and genius.
Well done, Chili.
Tom Canning, the heating was on.
Yes. Graham Robert Watkins. He left a note saying WrestleMania 33. 33 is the sum of the divisors of the first six positive integers at WrestleMaths.
Is that true?
It is true, yeah.
Excellent stuff.
Matt Blythe. There was a half-empty can of dog food and your house looked like a hurricane had hit it. So, oh wait, I'm sorry, that was Ken Shamrock.
Vincent Krasauskas. Your Sky Plus box is full of episodes of Banged Up Abroad and Tipping Point.
Yes.
It isn't, sadly. It's full of episodes of South Park, Match of the Day,
Naked and Afraid.
And Naked and Afraid.
I've not seen any of that in a while. We watched a few episodes that time. It was quite entertaining. Oh, I was going to say, I've not been watching a lot of telly recently.
Great. Is that your whole story of that one?
Well, I bet you don't watch this, do you? Do you ever watch Four in a Bed?
No.
Do you know what it is?
I think Adam's watched something called Four in a Bed, but I imagine it's probably different to the show you're about to talk about.
Do you know the show, Joe? Do you know what?
What's it about?
It's like Bed and Breakfast People.
No, I've not watched that.
So it's like, it's four bed and breakfast owners and they all like take it in turns to stay in each other's bed and breakfasts. And they have to like...
Critique,
but also they kind of like have to pay each other kind of what they think it's worth. It's quite interesting, lots of arguments and conflict.
Sounds thrilling.
Yeah. Sam Hayden, he left a note. It was a thoughtful gesture. Mr. Scrivens is a good egg, really. The note was handwritten and in nearly impeccable handwriting. There you go, Paul. At least one nice one that doesn't involve you making a mess, as I'm sure you'll point out about halfway through these being read out.
Aww.
Well, I managed to hold off, but thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much for all of your suggestions. That was a pretty tenuous one, but I think it turned out pretty well. Might be one of my favourites.
I enjoyed it. Was it Chili Morrison? Oh, that was brilliant. We should start working out some kind of prizes, because that deserves something special.
Okay, we'll see what we can do. Well, now I have to, now you've said it. But
an autographed picture of Scrivens.
As it happens, though, nobody actually guessed the correct answer.
Yeah, I actually don't know what it is. I did have a go earlier, and I was told I was close, but not right.
I knew for certain that Paul had been in the house, as there was a two-thirds eaten tub of his favourite ice cream, Co-op Venezuelan chocolate, in the freezer.
Right, on a side note about this, I found out a couple of weeks ago that they do another one in the same series that's like a coffee flavour, like an espresso one, and that's probably better. I will say I've had three tubs of it in the last 10 days.
what's it called? Co-op espresso flavour ice cream?
Yeah, I think they taste the difference.
That's Sainsbury's.
No, Sainsbury's. Irresistible, I don't know. But whatever their kind of luxury own-brand thing is, it's that. But, like, really highly recommended. And if anything, I'm quite interested to have the chocolate one and the coffee one together.
Well, you know what? There's still some in our freezer, and there's a Co-op down the road.
And maybe, like, on a tiramisu as well, because I think that would work.
And if you head over to our Patreon page, you'll find a one-hour audio of Paul reviewing different flavours of ice cream.
Could do that.
We should totally do that.
So, Wrestling with Shadows was originally released on December 20th, 1998, and chronicles the final year of Bret Hart's WWF career, from shortly before his re-signing with the company in October 1996, up to and including the infamous Montreal Screwjob at Survivor Series 1997 that we discussed last episode. Director Paul J reveals in an extra on the original release of the DVD that the crew being granted access to film at WWF events was part of Bret's conditions that he would return to the company. Bret wanted to show the art of wrestling through the film. McMahon even went so far as to sign a waiver to allow the use of WWF stock footage and the names and likenesses of the other wrestlers used in the film. But how did Bret leaving the company and the fallout from Montreal affect the film, you might ask?
How did it affect the film?
In fact, I'm pretty sure, like, if I didn't go into detail on it now, like, about 10 seconds into the movie, you'd all go, how come all this WWF footage is still in it, even though he's left?
Because I would assume that the answer is it didn't really affect it at all, because he still has, like, the post-Screwjob interview with Vince, and he's allowed to use that, which, while I was watching and thinking, that's a bit odd that Vince would consent to anything like that, because Vince wouldn't consent to that, so therefore he must have had his hands tied by whatever he previously signed.
Well, McMahon was naturally concerned about how he would be portrayed in the film and tried to block the use of the WWF footage. However, the filmmakers were contacted by WCW, who not only offered to pay the $750,000 they would need to fight Vince's lawsuit, but also offered them a pay-per-view deal for the film and long-term Turner distribution.
Wow.
When Vince caught wind of this, he faxed director Paul J and said he would drop the lawsuit and allow the use of the WWF footage in the film on the proviso that the film never be sold to Turner. Feeling that the WWF footage was integral to the story of the film and not really wanting to get tied up in a long court case, J accepted Vince's offer. He does, however, allege that he believes Vince used his influences in the US and overseas to kill some of the film's distribution deals.
That's really interesting that Turner would put up the money.
Well, I presume it was under the orders of Bischoff.
Bischoff, yeah, because I mean, Turner signs the checks, doesn't he? But such was the climate between the two companies at this time that they're willing to literally put in like hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay off Vince just to piss him off.
Yeah.
And put it on pay-per-view.
Yep.
Which is absolutely amazing to think, really.
I think it's quite interesting, though, just in the terms of the publicity that it'd buy.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
So I think that could work.
Yeah, like if you're Bischoff, I can see how you could really sell to higher-ups in Turner that, actually, if we get this film released and we put it on pay-per-view, we can hype the shit out of this and we can make a lot of money off having access to this film.
And we can, for pay-per-view, show footage from the WWF.
Because we've funded the lawsuit to get it cleared.
That, and that would be just mind-boggling, really.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's why, post-Montreal.
That's how it happened, because Vince is kind of over a bit of a barrel. There's nothing he can do about it.
The film was pretty well received. Today, it holds an 8.2 out of 10 on IMDb and was aired on BBC Two in the UK in 1999, which was the first place I saw it. It has since been released twice in the UK on DVD, once in 2002, and then again as a 10th anniversary edition in 2012, where it was paired with a television documentary also made by director Paul Jay called The Life and Death of Owen Hart. The latter DVD is still available on the Clear Vision website, who were the parent company of Silvervision, the former owners of the WWE license in the UK. Mm. If you've never seen it or perhaps want to watch it again, it's available to view on the Canadian National Film Board's website. I'll make sure I place the link in the episode description for ease of access.
All right.
So neither of you guys had seen this before.
I'd never seen it. Obviously, I was very aware of it and what it was, but I'd never actually watched it.
I wasn't even very aware of it until not that long ago, to be honest.
What were your kind of expectations going into it?
Pretty much what we got, actually. The thing that was different about it from what I did expect, I just didn't expect them to have the amount of footage used because of all the problems that actually happened with Brett exiting the company. So I expected there to be something in there, but I almost expected the footage available to have been vetted by Vince in order to make it seem in a certain way. But then upon watching it, it clearly hasn't really. It's the director's vision, what we're seeing.
Without the burden of insight, I thought it would be loads of backstage footage. That's kind of... I thought it would be much more day-to-day.
Right.
If that makes sense, because of how you described it as being almost like a year in the life of Brett. So I thought there'd be kind of more of that and less narrative.
So you expected it more kind of like a video diary than perhaps like...
More kind of like Wrestling Road Diaries
type
thing, perhaps, yeah.
Which is also a great film.
Yeah.
We open with a shot of Bret Hart walking through a backstage area at a WWF event whilst ethereal tribal music plays. It's used quite often in this film.
Mm.
We cut to Bret putting his gear on in a locker room before shots of a rabid WWF crowd, a sea of signs in their hands. Brett continues to get ready, lacing his boots and sitting pensively as we are shown The Undertaker walking to the ring. Brett paces towards the gorilla position as the music reaches a crescendo and we are shown the title of the piece, Hitman Hart, Wrestling with Shadows. Brett narrates black and white shots of himself. It's so hard to find a hero anywhere. I was proud of that Hitman character. He fought for the right causes and he spoke up and he told the truth. He always fought so hard. As per our discussions last episode and some footage later in the film, I'm guessing the match shown here is the six-man tag team bout from the night before Survivor Series, where Brett, Davey Boy Smith and Jim Neidhart took on The Undertaker, Steve Austin and Mankind. We cut to footage that was previously shown on WWF television of a ton of children chanting, "We want Hitman, we want Hitman," as Brett emerges with the WWF title on his shoulder. I loved being a hero to people around the world. I think of India, where these kids showed up and waited a whole afternoon just for me to come to the school. It's like a god coming to the school. They really believed in you and they really loved you. This was real. This was something you couldn't buy, Brett says.
Quite a grand opening, I think, in that sense.
Yeah, and logically it makes an awful lot of sense to have something closer to the present almost and then look back so you can start at a real point of intrigue, and then chronicle how you got to that point in the first place.
Well, this is juxtaposed with silence as Brett walks alone, dragging his suitcase down a hotel corridor. He says, "Tomorrow's the big showdown in Montreal. It's probably the biggest match of my whole life. This great story I've been living for the last 15 years could come to an end." Brett talks about how Vince has asked him to lose to Shawn, but he says he can't do it. He'd just as soon blow his brains out. Brett tells us that wrestling is far more real than people think, as he sits alone on a hotel bed and fidgets introspectively.
What did you make to him talking about blowing his brains out?
Well, and this is kind of a topic I think we'll probably discuss as we move through the movie, and it's something that's kind of always been known about Brett in general. He obviously takes himself very seriously.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I kind of thought the choice of language was a bit strange here, and for me, in other places, it is. So some of the kind of phraseology that he uses, I was kind of unsure of, and for me, doesn't necessarily fit with how I'd think of Hitman.
It's more serious a lot, but like you say, he takes himself very serious. But the phrase of blowing your brains out is quite dark, really, because he's essentially talking about the assassination of a character that he plays. But the language used is quite strong with it. But I guess that just reflects how strongly he feels about it.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's often used, like I say, as a criticism of Brett that he took himself too seriously. But I don't know. I guess to excel at anything, to a certain degree, you have to take yourself seriously.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, Steve Austin took his character seriously, you know, and an event you could kind of loosely compare to, you know, Brett talking about this is in 2002 when Austin is asked to lose to Brock Lesnar on an episode of Raw and he goes home.
Yeah.
Presumably that's because he takes his character seriously.
Yeah. And that, yeah, losing to Lesnar at that point is going to devalue and undermine and partially destroy the Stone Cold character.
Yeah, and he says it's not necessarily that he didn't want to lose to Lesnar full stop. He just felt kind of just throwing it out there on an episode of Raw was just not good business.
Yeah.
I guess in the same way, obviously, Brett feels losing to Shawn Michaels in Montreal is not good business. And quite frankly, as we discussed last episode, he just doesn't want to do it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I just felt that the choice of words was unfortunate, but it's interesting that kind of phrase that you use about the assassination of a character. That reverberates well with the ending of the documentary, really, doesn't it?
I have no sympathy for Brett whatsoever. None. Cuts in the dulcet tones of Vince McMahon. We see footage of the Jim Ross interview with Vince that we, again, discussed last episode. Vince lists his reasons as for why he feels that way and delivers his infamous line, "Brett screwed Brett." So we have the introduction of our villain.
Yeah.
Well, that's what he is in the movie, isn't it?
Pretty much, yes.
Sean's role in the movie overall is very minor.
Yeah.
Weirdly, isn't it?
Like, Sean's role is as a tool used by Vince. Okay, so they didn't really blame in it attached to Sean.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Brett does mention that he doesn't really... There's things about Sean that irritate him.
Yeah.
That he doesn't like about his character. But it's never implied that Sean's ideas and designs in order to do this. It's all that it's Vince's ideas and designs.
Well, and presumably at the time, you know, Sean was under instruction to deny anything. And again, we see that later in the movie.
Yeah.
Vince's mindset was very much, I will take the heat on this. You know, this will be nothing to do with you, et cetera, et cetera. So from a filmmaking perspective, even though, you know, we know from our own experiences that Brett really doesn't like Sean at this time, like, why would the filmmaker make that connection?
Even at this point, I don't think that Brett's anger is necessarily directed towards Sean because of this. It's all at Vince. So anything that he's saying is mostly down that avenue rather than down the Sean avenue. And there's no point in over-clogging it. You don't want two villains in the piece. You want one.
Well, that's interesting because it felt a little bit unbalanced in that way, perhaps, that Sean does have such a minor role in what I'd perceive very much a three-way situation.
Yeah, and I guess if either it was a longer film or if maybe they knew more about Sean's role in things, maybe you could have dredged up a lot more of the footage. Obviously, there's plenty of kind of on-screen stuff between Brett and Sean, and I'm sure there's probably extensive interviews of Brett talking about Sean. So maybe if at the time his involvement had been a bit more clear...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then maybe you would have had Sean as a secondary villain rather than a very minor character who is kind of portrayed, you know, he actually has nothing to do with it.
Mm.
We know Brett doesn't like him, but we don't necessarily know the extent of his involvement in this.
I'm guessing from the offset, the plan was to make like a 90-minute documentary.
Yeah.
And if you've got that sort of time constraint, have you got enough time to, you know, try and go down two avenues of plot? Probably not. So it's best just to stick to one and tell a good story or a complete story in that line rather than trying to overcomplicate it.
Well, it's also a bit of a strange thing because presumably until the year is up, you don't know what your story is going to be.
Yeah, and there's an interview kind of on the original DVD release with the director Paul Jay that, Adam, you and I watched after I finished watching the movie yesterday, where he says, actually, from a filmmaking perspective, the documentary God smiled on them in giving them this story. Because otherwise, what's the conclusion to the film? It's just very much a year in the life of Bret Hart. He's a wrestler. He wrestles here. He kind of feels it's a bit of an art and it's not really appreciated. Mm. And then it ends.
Yeah.
Like, because there's no big almost vindication of that storyline. There's no big reveal where the public suddenly accepts wrestling as an art form or the art form Bret believes it is.
Yeah.
So kind of without Montreal, do you really have a satisfying conclusion to the movie? Probably not.
I think... Yeah, without Montreal, this would have been very...
Flat,
yeah,
I think,
it'd be
the point.
Story to it.
Without there is no moment. There is no climax in the film. It is just it starts off and goes along and you see his life and then he goes to WCW or something like that. If there's no sort of like shenanigans at the end, he just moves company.
No, I mean, there'd be points of minor interest and interesting footage, but there'd be just literally, like say, no story.
Yeah.
As that interview fades to black, hopeful music plays and a caption appears on the screen telling us that we are 1 year earlier. As with any form of media, certain liberties have been taken with regards to storytelling, and this is one of them. The scenes we are about to see are from the Canadian Stampede in Your House weekend in July 1997, but as the filmmaker wants to tell the story from Brett's decision to return to the WWF in October of 1996 through to Survivor Series 1997, he's kind of using this footage, I think, to kind of show happier times.
Mm. Yeah.
Doc Hendricks introduces Brett to a Calgary crowd, and he is shown signing autographs. Brett tells us that he's been a professional wrestler for the last 20 years, and for the majority of that time, he's worked for Vince McMahon. As we see the WWF crew setting up their pay-per-view, Brett talks about how big the company has become, and that he's told that every week, over 500 million people watch their programming. Not sure about that one. Backstage, Brett tells us about a recurring dream he has, where his music hits and he hasn't got dressed for his match.
That's a sort of having a dream where you're naked in school, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
So what psychologically does that say about Brett?
I don't know. I think it's one of those fairly common dreams that like most people have, isn't it? Like
paranoia
not being
unprepared.
Ready.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Have you ever had it?
Not where I'm about to go main event and I'm not ready. No.
But just like going to work or going to school
and you're running late or something. That'd be another kind of variation on a theme for it. Something's going wrong. And either something's going to go wrong at work or at school, or you're not going to get there on time.
I probably have. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but I'm sure I must have.
We are shown Brett fluffing a promo for his SummerSlam 1997 match with The Undertaker a number of times. We then see Brett in the locker room with his son Blade, who is wearing Savio Vega's hat. The rest of Los Boricuas then ask Brett if he thinks he's pretty. Brett says he doesn't think that. Brett talks about how Blade looks like him but acts like his wife, which is apparently a poor combination and gives him the personality of a rattlesnake.
A literal rattlesnake.
That's how he thinks about his wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was interesting that basically Los Boricuas are there ripping on Brett. It felt like a very kind of strange locker room.
Inside the empty arena, Brett is being mic'd up, with the female interviewer not believing that he's just turned 40. Brett says he'll look it after the match that night.
She was very flirtatious with him.
She was very flirtatious, yes.
Did you think she was very flirtatious, Adam?
I guess so.
Brett narrates that these days he wrestles with the Hart Foundation and highlights the skills of his brothers-in-law Davey Boy Smith and Jim the Anvil Neidhart and his brother Owen Hart. He doesn't mention the loose cannon Brian Pillman.
What does he say is the particular skill set of Neidhart? Because he definitely says, oh, Davey Boy's the strongest man, and Owen, who's like one of the most technically accomplished wrestlers. And then,
he's a character.
And then he says, Jim Neidhart, he's a character.
That's what he says, he's a character.
He should have said he's the most bonkers man in the Wrestling Federation.
They said he's got to see like a funny little beard.
He's got a good laugh.
He's got a unique body shape.
Yeah. I thought that was Greg the Hammer Valentine.
We go back to the Hart's locker room where Brett preps Jim Neidhart for an interview with Vince Russo looking on. Brian Pillman, Owen Hart and Jim Cornette can be seen in the background.
Sorry, question for you. Why do you think they don't introduce Pillman?
I just wonder if it's because of his death. He's not a family member either, I guess.
But this section of the film is very much meet the characters, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what this is.
But it's a massive thing when Pillman dies. Would it detract away from the main point that they want to go with the documentary if they have to suddenly weave in that Pillman's death into it?
But the thing is, like you say it's meet the characters. I actually don't think like Neidhart, Owen or Davey aren't really characters in the film.
They're not characters in the film, but like this section, you're kind of meeting the wrestling characters, as it were.
I mean, I guess the thing you might say is because that they're all present at Montreal, and obviously, as he's passed, Pillman isn't.
But I do think that, I mean, they do talk about other wrestlers here, and that's kind of, I didn't write that note in my notes until kind of further down, so we got a lot further through the list of the characters that I think or feel like I'm being introduced to. But I do think it's maybe a little bit strange that if this is chronicling a year in Brett's life, and maybe Brett just didn't want that intrusion, but, you know, the Pillman stuff would be a huge part of that.
But do you not think then if they were to introduce that in a plot, as Adam says, in like a 90-minute documentary, it might end up eating too much of the A-plot's time, especially as the A-plot builds to such a crescendo? There's no real B-plot in this documentary.
And also, if this is from a documentary perspective and you've got people that aren't necessarily wrestling fans watching it, there is the risk that actually the main end of it, the main plot point, if you include all the Pillman stuff in there, that people would think, what's the big deal? Because, like, Pillman actually died. That's a bigger deal than his character just ending and then moving on to another place. And yeah. It would detract from the main focus of the film.
Yeah. The Anvil talks about getting hungry and losing his manners. This leads into a group interview with Doc Hendricks, where the Anvil repeats the promo Brett has just given him. We see the Legion of Doom cut their portion of their quintet's promo. Brett talks about how wrestling always has been, and probably always will be, filled with some of the most unbelievable, bizarre and outrageous characters. We are shown Goldust having his face paint applied. Brett talks about how Goldust pushes a gay homophobic button and that a lot of people take great offence to him. Dustin Rhodes is then shown out of makeup with the Road Dogg and one of the Harris twins doing an extremely camp voice.
Well, see, and this is where it feels like meet the kind of characters, because, you know, Goldust doesn't really
impact on anything.
Which doesn't it raises its head, I think, in terms of, I forget what the show's called, that is on later on.
Off the Record.
Off the Record, that kind of stuff. So it does feed into it, but for me, this is kind of setting a bit of the wrestling scene.
Yeah, and I guess it's meant to, like you say, just demonstrate the world and the kind of personalities that exist in there.
Yeah.
I mean, it is an interesting question to kind of tackle quite early on. Like, if you weren't a wrestling fan, how well do you feel this movie would kind of set up what wrestling is like?
I think it's there to show that the characters are completely different from the people. So Goldust isn't actually sort of this super Goldust character. He's another person. And they talk about Vader, who's like this monster in the ring, but is actually a big teddy bear. And, you know, so the people that they're talking about is to show that here's a wrestler, that's what they're like in the ring, this is what they're like in person. So the wrestlers are different from, the people are different from the character.
I think it's quite interesting because, you know, are you talking about kind of overall throughout the film?
Yeah, I just mean in terms of, like, if you weren't a wrestling fan and you sat down and watched this film, like, how well do you feel the film explains the world?
I'd be confused. Like, to be perfectly honest, because I agree with what Adam says about that portion, about the kind of the difference between the kind of the characters and the wrestlers' own personalities. But then you get to all the stuff about kind of Stu Hart and kind of that side of things and Dungeon, which looks quite terrifying. And so I'd kind of get perhaps a bit mixed up because for me, the stuff that they're doing, the Dungeon and all that side of things, is quite different to the WWE side of things.
Brett says that Dustin is anything but the character he plays. He's a Texas hick with cowboy boots who likes country music. Various fans are shown justifying their love of professional wrestling. One of them says, quote, "It's just fun. There's not a lot of things in life that are fun anymore. You cheer your favourites and you have your people you don't like, you boo them. You don't have to worry about someone punching you in the face because you booed them. It's their job." Brett is then shown hugging Vader, saying he's a big baby and you can hurt his feelings really easily. Vader tells us that he has a degree in business and is a licensed real estate broker.
He says he's investing in a shopping centre as well.
Yeah.
I like Vader. He's a good guy.
Would you go to Vader's shopping centre?
Depends what time it's open. If it's just open at, like, Vader time, it might be inconvenient. Sunny, in a rather lovely outfit, is highlighted, with her taking off her shoes in the ring and Jerry the King Lawler saying she can take off anything she wants. Brett is then backstage with her. He says she's very flirtatious, but to him, she's just a good friend, and that's all. Sunny tells a story of how in awe she was of touching Brett's hand as a child and that she wouldn't tell him that now for fear of embarrassment.
I think this is all there to try and put to rest those rumours that Brett was having a bit of Sunny.
Possibly, but yeah, like, she's very flirtatious with him. Yeah. I guess she might just be that way with everybody, yeah. Yeah.
To be honest, I thought she comes off quite well in the documentary, the little bits we see of her.
Yeah, it's a very human side of her, I guess. Mm.
I thought that kind of that story was quite a sweet, nice story that, you know, go back to when we first saw Sunny. What year was it? Kind of like 95?
Yeah,
like,
SummerSlam 95.
Okay. And you think about kind of how good she was in that manager role, how she kind of got wrestling and got the role of a manager. And you do get to see that side of it, you know, with that story that she is a true wrestling fan, which I like.
WWE.com's greatest WrestleMania entrance of all time is shown. Shawn Michaels descending from his place in the heavens at WrestleMania 12. I should back that up, Paul. We ended up just watching a bunch of list videos the other day on YouTube, kind of one after another, and one of them was greatest WrestleMania entrances of all time. And from the moment number 20 hit, I said to Adam, number one will be Shawn on the zip line, and I was bang on.
Was it not Randy Orton's big sperm?
It wasn't Randy Orton's big sperm. Undertaker's one at 29 was number two, wasn't it? Which I'm a big fan of.
Good, yeah.
Where it looks like the zombies are sort of crawling at his feet.
Mm.
Brett says that Shawn is a great athlete and an incredible performer in the ring, but there's things about Shawn that annoy him. Michaels apparently has a prima donna personality and thinks he's better than everybody else. There's something very arrogant and obnoxious about him. Very unlikable, Brett says. Brett details that the stage he and Michaels and the others perform on was created by Vince McMahon. He really turned wrestling upside down and changed it completely. Vince's opening from WrestleMania 3 is shown, followed by the Raw is War opening video package, and finally the Bret Hart advert from 1994. Go get 'em, champ. Brett concludes, and me? I'm Brett the Hitman Hart. If your kids are watching me on a Saturday morning, they're pretty safe. I send out a wholesome message. The Hitman stands for sticking up for yourself and never quitting. The one thing I won't do is lie to my fans.
I kind of quite like that bit. I think it's a good timing in the documentary to kind of put that in.
And I guess if you were to say that the story kind of, not necessarily as a B-plot, but the sort of underlying theme, I guess, of the whole piece as it builds is kind of that conflict between where Vince wants to take wrestling and where Brett thinks wrestling should be. That's certainly explored kind of in the latter third of the film.
Mm, yeah.
The ending of Canadian Stampede is shown, with Brian Pillman and Bret Hart helping Stu Hart get into the ring to celebrate with the rest of the Hart family. Brett says he's really only worked for two promoters in his career, Vince McMahon and his father. We cut to the Hart House in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and see Stu sat thoughtfully in a chair. Brett says he spent much of his career trying to prove himself to Vince McMahon, but ultimately was always about proving himself to his dad. Footage is shown of the family gathered around for Stu's birthday. Brett tells us that their parents had 8 boys and 4 girls. All 8 boys became wrestlers, and all 4 girls married wrestlers, which is not quite what his mom had in mind.
Well, how many candles were on that cake?
Well, quite a few.
But Jerry Lawler would have had a field day.
I noticed he didn't seem to be invited to this gathering.
No.
Funny that.
Shocker.
That really just stood out to me because the cake is all candles. You'd need a fire extinguisher to put that lot out.
Which one would you use?
Powder. Render the cake inedible.
Helen Hart is interviewed and says that she asked Stu how long they'd be in the wrestling business. He told her 2 years, but 20 years later, she asked him why they were still in it. Helen says she hates it and that it's worse now than ever. She says her family couldn't be any more deeply involved in the wrestling business than they are. After Stu blows out his birthday candles, Brett gives a speech where he says that the one person he's always looked up to and wanted to be was his father. Brett says it wasn't easy growing up with a legend for a dad. He tells the story of Stu's youth, of how Stu's father ended up in a dispute with someone over some land, and Stu and his 2 sisters ended up in foster care. Brett says Stu fell in with a club of shooter submission-style wrestlers. The idea was that they would give him so much punishment that he never came back, but he did. Stu laughs about it and says every day he was stretched pretty good, but he was anxious to learn. Brett says it wasn't long before Stu was the one dishing out the pain. Brett says learning from Stu and his style of wrestling helped prepare him for professional wrestling where you have to be able to take a lot of abuse. I'll give a plug here for possibly the final time to Pain and Passion, The History of Stampede Wrestling by Heath McCoy, which contains quite an extensive biography of Stu and Helen Hart. So if you are interested in kind of where their background came from and how they met and that kind of thing, it's detailed quite extensively there.
Because this was quite interesting because I think you talked about him being anxious to learn. I'm sure it mentions he said he was anxious to be a bully.
Okay, did I get that wrong?
I'm not sure if you get it wrong. I think it might have been both. But I'm sure he kind of talked about being, you know, changing those positions around and being that position. But I might be wrong, but I'm sure that's what I heard. But the other thing is that, for me, like a big theme of this is about father-son relationships.
I wondered if you'd tap into that.
But do you not think this
is... Oh, yeah, totally,
this,
yeah.
Kind of throughout this film, you know, he talks about Vince being a father. You kind of... There's a lot of stuff... Well, he doesn't talk about it necessarily being a dad, but there's a lot of stuff with him and Blade. And for me, that's quite actually a big theme of this documentary is kind of fatherhood and trying to please your dad.
Did you pick up on kind of the filmmakers' very deliberate attempts to contrast the stories that Brett gives of his youth with Stu compared to how he's shown with Blade?
No. go explain.
So, you know, the story So he tells of kind of his youth with Stewie is very much, he pushed us greatly, but, you know, I kind of respect him for it. But I think there's even one point where Brett says, like, I'm not that way with my kids. And you take a scene like the one in the taxi later on where he's trying to show Blade where his neck hurts and he's saying, you know, you'll have to walk on this later for me. Like, did you get an impression that was to set a deliberate contrast between how he was brought up and how he's choosing to raise his own children?
I kind of appreciated that. I mean, I perhaps fixated a little bit more on Brett and Stu.
Right.
More like, although I noticed bits with Blade, and I thought it was kind of quite interesting that the focused a lot on them as a couple, because Blade just seems to go everywhere that
Brett goes. Brett does. Which seems to be true still today.
but no, I just thought it was absolutely kind of fascinating that, because there is that kind of drive. You know, I think for a lot of people outside of wrestling or whatever, it is that kind of that need to please and that need to kind of live up to your father's expectations.
Yeah.
But also the effect that it has on how you will raise your kids.
It depends on how your relationship with your father goes. And I think this doesn't necessarily point to kind of like almost like an abuse type thing in Brett's childhood, where he was having to like do all these wrestling stuff. But to a lot of people, that would sound like kind of torturous, actually. And what he's doing is he respects and loves his dad, but he doesn't want to give the same experience to his kid.
Yeah.
And that's quite true throughout a lot of people. I don't have kids, obviously.
That
I know about. But how did you get on with your dad, and what type of dad do you want to be? Do you respect and like your dad enough to want to be like your dad and give your kid the same experiences as you had? Or did you feel that strongly against it that you want to give a completely different experience to your kid?
And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon.
Little something, something, yeah.
But that's interesting, because it's that whole thing about learning about where you're from and you know, learning, because you can learn if what you think your dad has done is good and you want to kind of emulate it and copy it and go down that route, that's fine. Or you can learn from it by thinking, that's not what I want for me. It's not what I want for my family.
And what do you think about your two kids? Do you emulate your own father and, you know, try and recreate what he did, or do you try and do something different?
I would say, if I look back now, I was massively unappreciative of everything that my dad did.
All kids are unappreciative, mate.
But in the sense of, my dad was quite strict, and actually it's harder to be strict than just to be nice and give in. And actually, that's actually a lot of effort, and that actually he did a fantastic job. And I'm not necessarily a strict kind of guy, and I might not go down that route myself, but I've got kind of this overwhelming respect now that I didn't have a few years ago.
Do you think that's akin to Brett's perception of his relationship with Stu then, and his desire to be a different way with his kids?
Possibly. Like I think it's difficult, because, I don't know, where's Brett in the kind of timeline of the other kids?
I actually couldn't tell you.
He's not the eldest, though, is he?
No, he's not the eldest. I think he's maybe halfway down, something like that.
You're not the eldest in your family, are you?
No.
So I don't know if you get this. So I was kind of very much felt that my brother was very successful kind of academically, and that I felt I also had like a lot to prove. And that was quite difficult, because I kind of always felt that my brother was perhaps my dad's favourite, because he was better academically than I was.
Wow.
Was he better at maths?
Yeah.
Shit.
Shocking revelations on this documentary about Bret Hart about Scribbins.
Oh my God, I've just realised I still want to prove myself. But I think it is that kind of, yeah, that kind of thing, perhaps. I don't know.
Has your brother got a podcast with over 1 million downloads?
Not that I know to.
Well, go tell your dad that.
Okay. Yeah.
Footage of Brett placing Mr. Perfect in the sharpshooter at SummerSlam 1991 is shown, and Brett says the early days learning from his dad helped him come up with the hold, though the general belief is that Conan showed it to him, so that might be a bit of creative license there. Brett says it takes a lot of skill and a lot of talent to make wrestling look real. He says his personal philosophy is that the real art of wrestling is doing it full contact, but never getting hurt or hurting anybody else. If anybody gets hurt, it's because somebody did something wrong. Brett says he's been wrestling 20 years and has never hurt anybody. Brett says to purposefully hurt yourself or your opponent, there's no art in that. Brett says to watch his punches. He connects on all of them. But did you ever wonder why there's no big bruise afterwards?
No, I didn't, actually, but good point.
Well, no, I didn't, because I knew why. Because if people, like these big muscly guys, if they start whacking each other full pelt in the face, then everyone's going to end up looking hideous after it. Though he's right, the art in it is making it look like that, but not actually hurting anyone at all.
But it's quite a pertinent point, actually, that we're watching it this week, and this is probably something neither of you guys are aware of. There was a New Japan match last weekend. I've not seen it myself, but there was a chap wrestling in that, Katsuyori Shibata, who's been over to England a couple of times in the last year, but his style is very realistic, shall we say. And over the past few months, he's been delivering some very realistic headbutts in the sense that he's headbutting people. So he's had this big match last weekend with Okada in Japan, and he's delivered this tremendous headbutt, and now it's very likely that he'll never be cleared to wrestle again based on the after effects of this headbutt.
Wow.
So is Brett right in that sense?
What's he done?
I couldn't tell you the medical ins and outs of what it is he's done, but the word seems to be that it's very unlikely.
So he's damaged himself so badly.
Yeah.
How hard must that headbutt have to be to do that?
I mean, you can watch it. It's online. It makes a sickening noise when
you
connect with it.
Yeah, I don't think I want to watch that.
There's one a couple of months ago that's even worse, actually. But does that make Brett's philosophy correct?
Yeah, well, it's got to be safe, hasn't it? And he's talking about safely effective. Something that looks good but is safe. And there's lots of... Obviously, it's a massive thing in wrestling, isn't it? The safety of how things are. Yeah, you have to keep things safe. Otherwise, with the schedules and things that they do and the amount that they work, people end up in hospital. People end up irreparably damaged by it. So his philosophy on how it should be is absolutely correct. It has to look good, otherwise no one believes it.
Yeah.
But you cannot do full contact because people will die and their careers will be shortened and it will just be horrible. So there's a very fine line that needs to be taken. Some people get it and some people don't. I know we're all big fans of like Razor Ramon's punches being absolutely incredible, and we never saw anyone with missing teeth or black eyes after he'd punched them. So he's doing something right. And then we've all seen people who throw punches and don't actually hit because I guess they haven't got the skill level to safely contact with someone without shattering the cheekbone or something.
I think the way he expresses it is quite good that it's not art, because if I think about some of the matches that I would choose as perhaps some of my favourite wrestling matches from the kind of WWE, and I'd think about lots of mine would be stuff with maybe like Mick Foley, that kind of stuff, and Shane O'Mac, one with Kurt Angle and stuff, and lots of those aren't very
safe,
yeah. And in fact, you know, they get injured. But the thing is that they are entertaining.
Yeah.
But I think Brett is right. That is not art then. Well, they make for interesting matches and a spectacle, but they don't necessarily make art.
What entertains you tears their bodies apart. I've heard that somewhere before.
What?
This cuts to Brett in a taxi, saying that nobody ever comes up to him and says you're a hell of an athlete. They just tell him he's a big phony wrestler. Brett says it's like he's been defending wrestling his whole life. To the other kids, they were the phony wrestling family. Alison Hart says that the other kids would tease her mercilessly, and Brett says his sisters bore the brunt of this. Ellie and Georgia Hart back this up. Brett tells a story of defending Georgia from a bully 2 years older than him, even though the general opinion was that he was going to get his butt kicked. Brett says he beat the crap out of the kid, and afterwards a bunch of kids hoisted him up on their shoulders. He compares it to the end of WrestleMania 10, when the babyface locker room did the same thing, which Brett claims he didn't know they were going to do. Diana Hart says it was a great moment.
It's a really weird story, though, isn't it? Because didn't he say that as he was on his way out to have a fight, one of the teachers was like, good luck, man. And then he batters this kid and then gets raised up as a hero by the rest of it. It's just a really weird story. I don't know if that's how things work in Canadian high schools.
Well, I mean, yeah, presumably this was like the late 60s or something when this is occurring. It's kind of a different time.
Yeah. But it's interesting, the kind of that, it's kind of that, the realness of that reaction to it, where it is almost like a match to him.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like, rather than a, right, I've ended that kind of bullying conflict.
I mean, it's never outright stated, but I'm going to assume here that, as kids, the Hart kids weren't clued in that wrestling was fake.
Okay.
That would be my best guess.
Well, I guess if from what we see of Stu's training regime,
yeah,
and they go down to his dungeon and get their asses kicked, they probably don't think it's fake. So they're probably a bit confused by people calling them fakes and phonies, because they're like, well, no, fucking hurts, man.
Yeah, to be honest, go and stand in that living room.
Brett says that the other kids didn't understand that to the Hart kids, wrestling was real. Keith Hart tells the story of people claiming they could take him or his wrestlers on and does a great impression of Stu inviting these guys to come down and take him on in the dungeon.
Brilliant. Keith Hart is a star in this.
We hear audio allegedly recorded by Owen under the instruction of Bruce of someone being stretched by Stu and screaming in agony as the camera winds through the Hart house. Have some discipline, says Stu, as a country song plays in the background. Keith says it was the measure of a man, just to see who would submit.
Yeah, it's kind of, so yeah, that's what's your opinion as a measure of a man?
How long you can get put in an abdominal stretch by Stu Hart?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that was their test, like all these people who would come to the wrestling and presumably either A, believe it was fake, or B, think, you know, I can do this, I can take these guys on. I guess Stu was like, okay, let's see if you can.
Funny as I like, maybe our measure of a man isn't really that.
Be height.
I think it's normally whether you can assemble flat pack furniture.
I can do that. Change the tire. Nearly.
Mate, well, the shelf on this table that you assembled in here is upside down.
Yeah, that's years ago. I've improved a lot since then.
Have you?
In the present day, Stu takes a trio of unwitting victims into the dungeon. The middle one is a tall, bald guy and is particularly cocky, telling Stu, I'm ready. I'll take some moves, sir. Presumably thinking, what the fuck is this 8-year-old guy going to do to me? Keith claims that his father isn't a sadist, but a gentle, loving guy. The next thing we see is our bold friend, his head turned bright purple, screaming for his life.
Yeah, that guy still knows some moves, doesn't he?
After letting the guy go, Stu explains to the trio why he was doing what he did, and the volunteer certainly seems a lot more humble. He's definitely humble when Stu again places him in a submission and shows the veins pulsing in his head and how his lips are turning blue. The guy screams in agony, and we cut to the outside of the Hart house at night time.
It's nice. It's a really cool house.
It's a really big house.
Yeah, it's massive.
Presumably if you've got 12 kids, you need a few bedrooms.
But don't you think like the interior is really lush?
It's okay. I wasn't really paying attention to the decor.
I imagine they're not short of a bob or two.
But what did you make to this scene with Stu and his sort of volunteers?
Quite, I don't know, uneasy. I mean, it's really impressive in a way that kind of like he clearly is such a student of that style of wrestling that absolutely knows it inside out and the reasons why
you're
doing everything. Because I guess it's one thing to do the move, but probably another one to know the rationale behind why the move is effective.
And what muscles it places stress on, etc.
So I thought that kind of thing was really kind of interesting and exciting, but also the kind of like, there's a slightly sinister edge to it. Just kind of the glee that he has when he's talking about it.
I wasn't a massive fan of it. I can see why it's there, and it certainly has a different perspective to show on Stu Hart, and I think that they must be aware of how has Stu been portrayed on TV in the last few years.
Old.
And it's mostly just Jerry Lawler ripping on him for being an old man. So a lot of the audience aren't going to know that Stu Hart is actually was a really accomplished and great wrestler of a certain style. So it's there for a reason. I think it's quite contrived, and I don't think that necessarily they would have just happened to have come across these guys who would just come around and say, yeah, well, this sounds like good fun. They would have gone out and found some people and said...
Do you think that? Because I genuinely think they probably do have people going to their house going, show us how to wrestle.
I think it was probably a bit more set up than that.
Okay. Brett says he remembers his dad stretching him so hard he would go to school the next day with blood red eyes from burst blood vessels. Brett says he begged for his life on numerous occasions and believed he was taking his last breath, a notion Stu would affirm for him. Brett stares out into the night and claims he was deathly afraid of his father. We see his father now, an elderly man in his favourite armchair. Brett says now he sees through his father's eyes, and it must have been tough to raise 12 kids. Brett says a lot of what Stu did to them was how he was brought up himself. Brett says the difference between him and his father is that he'd much rather have a rubber toy screaming in his basement. We cut to perhaps the most disturbing shot of the entire documentary, and perhaps the entire run of the podcast. Some horrific model that looks like an extra from a Tool video, rocking violently back and forth in an electric chair, its face etched with agony. Brett sits on the stairs next to it, saying it's bizarre that he wants it in his house, but for him, this is pretend, and all too many other times, it wasn't.
I wouldn't want that in my house.
I wouldn't want that in my house.
It reminded me of The X Factor. Not the the Iron Maiden album. Not,
I thought
not
you
the,
meant that
the
show with like Anton Deck
yeah,
on it.
Like, yeah, like shit. I haven't watched it, but maybe I should.
It really makes me scream sometimes. That show.
Yeah, the cover for the X Factor by Iron Maiden. Yeah, it's very similar to that.
But kind of, do you think it's very dark?
Yeah, yes, it's pretty horrible. And I guess it's something that he's purchased out of a haunted house ride.
Yeah,
something like that. Yeah.
But why, in the name of God, you'd want that in your house is beyond me, but I guess he's got his reasons for it.
But again, on the kind of the extras on the original DVD, the director says, like, there was very much a moment where Brett made the connection that the reason he had that in his house was because it was fake, whereas the kind of the pain that he went through in his childhood was a lot more real.
Now, and that sort of dialogue, that does make it seem like abuse. And that there's a point of learning wrestling, but when he's describing how he thinks he's going to die and his dad is affirming that for him.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty dark stuff.
Yeah, it was like you breathed your last breath and he's thinking, I'll probably have, I'm envisioning newspaper headlines of professional wrestler gone too far.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty dark stuff.
But also, like, when he says, I'm afraid of my father, or was afraid of my father, you know, it's kind of that dark side to it.
We see shots of Brett growing up, and he says he never wanted to be a wrestler. Stu wanted Brett to be an amateur wrestler and go to the Olympics. We see footage from Stampede Wrestling, which Brett says his father owned. Brett says he got into the wrestling business by accident at the urging of his dad. He says his parents' business was going under, and it was tearing his mother apart. It was not long after this, Brett says that he met Vince McMahon. Stu sold his territory to Vince, and Brett went to the WWF. Brett says Stu learning to live without wrestling was very tough for him. Brett says that when he joined the WWF, he started at the bottom and had to scratch and claw his way to the top, and that every day he works hard not to come out of the wrestling business a tragedy, which is what happens to so many. Stu shows Brett a magazine that says that Brett is the most famous Albertan in the world. Brett says he's been working for Vince McMahon for the better part of 14 years, and he always figured he'd end his career there, but Ted Turner and his WCW organisation have come along and made him a fantastic offer for an incredible amount of money. Brett swims in his pool and tells the camera that they've offered him $9 million over 3 years, which is beyond anything he could ever imagine. Brett says Vince offered him a lot less money, but did offer him a 20-year contract. Brett says this is a tough time as he decides what to do, but that money isn't everything. He says he feels like the prettiest girl at the dance and that he has everybody vying for his attention. Brett says that Vince used to be the king of wrestling until Ted Turner decided to get into it. Brett is in awe of these two huge media giants fighting over him. Brett says his contract is up and he's free to go wherever he wants. It should be a simple decision, go and take the money. But he says Vince McMahon made him and gave him the chance to make his dreams come true, and that weighs very heavily on the decision he has to make. But $9 million is a lot of money.
Does he actually say, oh, I might have just written this, should I stay or should I go?
I think he does say that.
Because I was flabbergasted that he didn't play that song. But it's kind of a very interesting section. Like some of the imagery that Brett conjures up about being things like talking about the prettiest girl in the dance and kind of like his analogies for things are quite interesting, because there's one later that I quite like as well.
This was all stuff that I obviously knew, and I didn't think that it added a great deal. It simply explained the point that he's here, this person wants him, this person wants him, this person's offered this, this person's offered this. I didn't think that it offered up anything like revolutionary in this section.
Well, it's not for us because we've had Stuart talking
exactly. So from,
but in terms of the storytelling,
the storyline, it is a crucial linchpin to it because you have to understand who these people are and why they want in and who's offering what.
Footage is shown from the October 21st, 1996 episode of Monday Night Raw, where Bret Hart announced his decision to stay in the World Wrestling Federation. The shots of Vince McMahon anxiously sat at ringside are included.
And I like that.
That's one of my favourite moments. Yeah. Like, and I don't know if you guys watched that at the time, but Vince's face when kind of Brett announces he's staying with the WWF is, I can't even describe it. It's just amazing.
So it's all right. Yeah.
I was amazed that Brett told him like that and just didn't talk to him backstage. Because you could not fake those emotions.
It's spectacular acting on the part of Vince.
Brett says he will be in the WWF forever, and Vince looks tremendously relieved. Brett's guest spot in The Simpsons is shown, transitioned into him watching it with his daughter. Brett says you try to do what is best for your family, but how much money do you need? Brett says sometimes he feels torn between his family and showing his loyalties. A family dinner is shown before Brett washes his gear. Brett compares his relationship with Vince to his relationship with his father, leaving Vince at this point in time with WCW breathing down his neck and overtaking him in the ratings wouldn't feel right. Loyalty is important, Brett says.
Mm. Well, one of the things that was quite interesting is he was cooking topless.
Yes, he was.
Which I'd never recommend.
No, especially not anything that you're maybe it's, frying or something. Yeah. Something that would spatter.
Anything that spatters is a bad idea.
Did you know Brett had a guest spot in The Simpsons?
Yes.
Oh, no, I'd seen it.
But I've not seen the episode. Is it good?
It's the one where Mr. Burns has to sell his mansion, isn't it? Because Brett ends up buying it, I think.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it's been years since I've seen it. Thinking about it, at the time, Brett getting a spot in The Simpsons is a pretty big deal, actually.
Oh, yeah,
the
absolutely.
The Simpsons was huge then, so...
Have any of the wrestlers had a spot in it?
They must have done. Rowdy Roddy Piper was in it.
What?
Do you not remember that episode?
Yeah. Rowdy Roddy Piper. What episode is it?
It's the Venus de Milo gummy bear one, isn't it?
Okay.
I like
gummy bears.
So this is also quite an important point in terms of how the rest of the story plays out. Brett basing his decision on deciding to stay with Vince upon loyalty and the fact that he feels kind of jumping at this point would just be really dishonourable.
But do you think that, again, let's bring it back to the father thing, Brett sees Vince as his dad?
Exactly.
So, yeah, I do.
Brett says he's now back in the WWF and that it isn't long before he has a match in front of both Vince and his father. Brett arrives backstage at a WWF show, his kids in tow, and we see him meeting Vince. Brett says in his first few meetings with McMahon, he was suspicious of him, intimidated, and a little awestruck. We see Vince talking to Brett's kids, which is an uncharacteristically human moment for the WWF owner.
I still like the way he was mimicking his funny walk.
Yeah, the walk, the walk he ends up doing for his character. Yeah. Brett and Vince need to talk business as Vince decides the direction of the company, so Brett tells his kids to go bother the headbangers.
That is genius.
I guess they have some use. Yeah.
I think it really indicates their position in the pecking order of things, where at this point they are babysitters.
Did you have any things like, were you ever a nuisance when you were kids and got palmed off on people?
Probably.
Not necessarily on people, but just to, you know, go play outside, that type of thing. You're being a bother, go outside and build something.
Because I distinctly remember when I was quite little, just being so keen to play cricket, that after a while my dad or my brother or people would give up. And they'd say there was some kind of like, not old people, but like guys in their 20s, and say like, so go and bother them. So basically I'd bowl at them, they'd just hit it as far as they can. I'd just like trudge off and fetch the ball and... Go and get it again.
Hang on, your parents sent you off to basically perform the function of a dog.
Yeah, I think so.
Brett says that once Vince has decided who's winning the match, it's up to him and some others to come up with how they play that out. We're back at Canadian Stampede, so Brett discusses the idea of incorporating his father and brothers into the match as they are in the front row. Brett says he usually seeks out Pat Patterson for this, as he has a great mind for visualising ideas. Bruce Hart, in his super cool jacket and shades combo, makes sure he is present for the meeting. Brett says he sees these things in his head before they happen, and Brett relays to Bruce the plans for the ending of the match and how Steve Austin should think Stu threw a drink over him. We all know how that played out. Because he turns around and Bruce is stood there with a cup in his hand.
But one of the things that I really like about this is there's a genuine look of joy when Brett is kind of working out and laying out that match.
Yeah.
And is it like, and he comes up, oh, and it could even be Stu's drink.
Yeah.
It's just like wonderful. Like, that was like a lovely moment of like,
but do you not
his
think,
passion for wrestling.
Like, yeah, like if you're an actual wrestler, which obviously we aren't, but like that creative process must be, or for a lot of people, must be like really good fun.
Yeah.
What I love is that Bruce Hart still was dressed like the Terminator backstage, like indoors, whilst filming for a documentary.
He probably thinks it's about him.
It's just like, I've got to look cool, I best put on my shades.
Hitman Hart, the Bruce Hart documentary.
He's probably keeping the filmmakers to one side going, boys, I've got this great idea for a film. It's about a small-time wrestling promotion that overthrows a larger one. As the show opens, we cut back to the Hart's locker room as Brett continues his discussion with Pat Patterson. we see Brett make his way through the curtain to an absolutely rapturous reception.
It was a really nice perspective seeing it from there, and you got a kind of sense for kind of how overpowering that reaction was.
We see footage of Brett giving his glasses to his mother, Helen, as we hear the audio of Pat and Brett discussing their plans. As the events of the match play out, we continue to hear the pair discuss what will happen. I thought this was one of the most fascinating parts of the documentary.
It was cool, yeah.
You know, because that's not something you generally or ever see, really, is kind of these minds going over what they're visualising to happen and then actually seeing it happen.
Hmm.
It becomes even more amazing to watch when we get slow motion footage of Bruce Hart climbing over the railing and falling over. Not that I'd forgotten, but this really reminded me how wonderful this match is and how cleverly the story transitions from Brett versus Austin to Owen versus Austin.
Yeah.
So you get that bit where they're talking at the start about how when everyone's brawling and the smoke clears, kind of it's you and Steve, and then they kind of transition it to Owen and Steve in the finish. Yeah, splendid.
And even just things about like that. Right, we need to calm the pace down to make it last. And no, it's very interesting, like you say, to see how they're just setting something out like that, particularly when you know what a good match it was.
Yeah. And when you get some slow motion footage, actually, that I know Brett's said that, you know, wrestling is an art, and that art of making contact but not hurting anyone. And I find it fascinating that Bruce Hart has not learned that at all. Because you get the punch that he hits on Austin's back where he just full on punches him. And it's not a wrestling punch. It's a fucking punch. Because Bruce Hart's Bruce Hart.
Absolutely. Do you think, or do you kind of get the feeling that, like, seeing Pat Patterson in that way, like, he's almost like a director? Like, you imagine, like, that's what a director would speak to an actor, like, in terms of, like, right, in this scene, what I want you to do, and then the actor's saying, oh, well, I could perhaps do it this way, and they're kind of going over that?
At this point, how involved is Pat Patterson in, like, all the workings of what's happening on WWE?
I'm fairly involved, yeah.
And how long does that continue up until?
I think he's a guy who, even up until latterly, they were still for big match finishes.
Yeah.
They were still seeking him out for kind of advice. And I think Royal Rumbles, I'm not sure how recently, but he was definitely involved in Royal Rumbles latterly because he was considered kind of the best mind for planning those out.
He's one of those interesting people, isn't he, that they're always ripping on and doing in sort of like really botchy spots, TV segments, things, but actually is so integral to how things are working and holds such a high esteem from everyone around that he's used in such a capacity and everyone trusts him. It's really interesting.
His autobiography has just come out, actually. They had it in the shop at WrestleMania.
Oh, right.
I didn't pick it up, but I will read it at some point. I kind of probably need to find some reviews of it just to see if it's a WWE kind of but if it's edited piece or if it's actually quite interesting.
If it's a real one from him, his knowledge of everything that's gone on will be fascinating.
Brett says that behind the curtain, wrestling is anything but fake and that even the best wrestlers have accidents. This is highlighted by Steve Austin being helped through the backstage area by two referees, an ice pack on the back of his neck, as Brett makes his way in the opposite direction to the curtain. I presume at this point we've transferred to SummerSlam 97.
Well, they made it look like this was off the back of Canadian Stampede.
Yeah.
Which I didn't think he was injured in. But I assume it must have been SummerSlam.
It's the process of mediation, isn't it? That you need something to look in a certain way, so you just cut the footage together and everyone that's watching it will just read it as that.
Yeah, and like I said, very early on, they kind of play fast and loose with the timeline here. Even with this scene in general, like, this is all happening before the storyline where Brett turns heel. And we know he's a face in Canada because of what eventually happens, but that might be too complex to kind of try and tell in the story that he turns bad guy, but then they go to Canada, he's still a good guy. And they kind of touch on it, but at this point, the image is very much Brett is a good guy character.
Yeah. It's funny, though, because it, again, my expectations of this documentary, like I was saying at the start, was like, I'm going to be following Brett for a year. And, like, it doesn't.
Brett says there was a time when he never, ever worried about getting hurt, just screwing up. But now it's the opposite. In the back of a car, Brett tells Blade about the time he broke his sternum in a match with Dino Bravo. The footage is included of Brett being knocked off the apron onto the steel railing. Brett says he was suffocating and didn't know if he'd punctured his lung. He says the worst thing was all the people screaming at him to get up. Brett says he didn't want to lose to Bravo, so in a stupid move, he put his foot on the ropes. Eventually, he rolled to the outside and was counted out. Brett says he was out for 7 weeks and that the WWF promised they'd look after him, but quickly he realised that his pay wasn't going to be particularly good whilst he was injured, so he was back in the ring way sooner than he should have been.
Right, so with this, firstly, why is this bit here now?
I guess just to show the realness of wrestling.
Okay, it's... I know, it feels a bit weird. This it felt very disjointed, this bit, I thought.
I think there's lots of kind of juxtaposition of the theatrics of wrestling
and the reality
and the real problems that can come with it. So we've just had this bit about them walking through and describing how the match is going to go, and it's a performance and it's set to a script, but then you also there are these injury parts, and it would make sense here to actually talk about Stone Cold's neck injury.
That's exactly what I thought.
But Stone Cold isn't the focus of this. Brett is, so you've got to find a point where he was injured for real and talk about it in that respect.
It's a funny one. I also felt it was a little bit strange in that he talks about not wanting to lose to Dino Bravo, because again, it doesn't feel like a very Brett thing.
I guess what he's saying is that maybe perhaps he was booked to win the match, but as he was booked to win it, he didn't particularly want to lose it, so he kind of forced himself to carry on as opposed to just taking the count out loss, which ultimately he ends up doing. I think it also subtly sets a seed of kind of saying that while he was injured, he didn't really get paid that much.
Okay.
Which crops up later on in terms of, you know, right at the very end where Brett's kind of talking about his feelings about Vince. Although he's set Vince up as this father figure that he's very much in awe of, you know, you can make that connection that he's the one that pays the checks. And then when Brett was injured, the checks weren't great. Brett says that when he was weighing up whether to sign with WCW or stay with the WWF, his loyalty to Vince McMahon played a big part, but there was something much more important than that. What would happen to the Hitman character in WCW? He knew one thing, that in the WWF, he'd always be the hero. Brett says that following his return at Survivor Series 1996, he was back to being the number one good guy in wrestling again. Brett says the key to being a great good guy is working with a great bad guy. Brett says Mankind is one of his favourites. Brett compares Mankind to Hannibal Lecter, and we see a brief montage highlighting the character, and Mick Foley talks about how he created it.
And for me, like, weirdly enough, my favourite things about this documentary are these little bits that you get of the wrestlers, where they talk about what they're doing. I found the fact that Vader's investing in a shopping centre fascinating. I love that. I absolutely love it. And I really like this bit about Foley just describing how he's created this character and what he does with it. And those bits for me are really interesting. I would like to see loads more of that.
I agree. And like the little backstage things, like go and bother the headbangers. That to me,
yeah.
like it might sound really petty, but like that kind of thing that nobody even bothers to talk about. That kind of what is the kind of like the dull, boring routine of the locker room, the backstage area. That's quite interesting because that story just never gets told.
Yeah, and we know things. I guess we do know things about like the bigger stars of it. We know a bit about how they created their characters. They've done biographies, so we know where they come from. I don't know, fuck all about the headbangers, but now we do know that they were babysitters for Blade. Okay, that's kind of cool.
I liked the fact that Brett references Mankind being one of his favourite characters because I really like that character. And it's like when you find out a musician you like likes other musicians you like. But it made me think, like, because we never really saw like a Brett Mankind feud. Mm. Like, Brett wasn't around when the Mankind character was kind of developing. And yeah, I actually think they probably would have had some really good matches.
Yeah.
Brett references another bad guy, Hunter Hearst Helmsley, a blue blood snob type character. Brett says he's a character the fans will never love. They'll always hate him.
Not very foresighted there, really.
Helmsley talks about audiences booing him out of the building when he curtsies. Yeah, you might be stretching a bit on that one in kind of early 97 Triple H. No one was really booing you out the building. Brett says something strange has been happening. The characters the fans are supposed to hate, they've started to cheer. Brett's example of this is one Stone Cold Steve Austin. Brett says Austin is the most evil guy in the company, but that the fans have started to cheer him and turn on Brett because Stone Cold is so bad, he's cool. Brett then says something that is incredibly pertinent 20 years later, and this is verbatim. In the end, the fans decide everything. If they cheer you, you're a good guy. And if they boo you, you're a heel.
Yeah.
McMahon recognised the way the crowd's reacting to Austin and is positioning him to be a fan favourite.
Now, this was... Yeah, I mean, I noticed this because I was put down. I mean, the fans decide everything, and my note is just Roman, Cena. So, no, they don't.
I've written, is that true? Alongside that, yeah.
It used to be true, I think.
Well, I guess, yeah.
Wasn't it just really... did you post it or somebody like top 10 moments, like crowd?
Yeah, there was a video actually this morning on Twitter that WWE posted of top 10 hostile crowd reactions.
That's it, yeah.
And it was saying the superstars can't ignore it. And my kind of sarcastic quip was, yeah, but management can. But unbelievably, Roman at Raw the other week was not included in this top 10 list.
Really?
Yeah.
What was top?
I mean, a few of them were kind of kayfabe hatred. So, like, one actually really good one was Vicky Guerrero absolutely getting booed out of the building.
Yeah.
I can't remember what number one was, but... No, sorry, I can. It was Cena at One Night Stand 2006.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that is vicious, actually. Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I guess that's the way it was for such a long time. And to pick an example from kind of the 80s, when they introduced the Honky Tonk Man, they let fans decide on whether he was a good guy or a bad guy.
Mm.
Based on kind of a fan vote.
Wow.
Whereas now they do that and then just do the opposite.
Yeah, or, well, it shows that even at this point in time, there is the ability to think, and we've mentioned it so many times on the podcast, I think, that, okay, he's getting this sort of reaction, we'll flip them to this sort of thing. And we see it with the Rock, don't we? We've seen it with the Rock. Try forcing him as a babyface, not working, getting booed, turn him a heel. Okay, perfect. But they just seem to have just abandoned that method of thinking.
Well, they don't, because I'll use a modern example of where they did do that. The New Day.
True,
introduced as baby faces. People booed them out of the building, so they turned them heel. 6 months later, they were the biggest merchandise sellers at WrestleMania 32.
But why can't they do that with their number one top-tier stars
anymore? It's a good question.
They are incapable of doing it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, something tells me, for those reasons we've just listed, Vince hasn't watched this documentary lately, if ever. Brett says that maybe there aren't any good guys anymore, as people seem to be sick of them. Back at home, Brett tells us that Vince has asked him to turn heel, become a bad guy, and that at first he was resistant to the idea as he took so much pride in being the good guy, but that McMahon has sold him on it. Brett guesses there's only so many times you can rescue the girl on the railroad tracks before people get bored of it. Brett then queries his wife Julie as to why she's given him an effeminate shirt. I guess it's to show him as being irritable as making this change.
Yeah, it felt a little bit weird.
Footage airs of the double turn at WrestleMania 13 with Brett and Austin. Brett says that, like a classic good guy, Austin won't ever give up, and like a real villain, Brett kicks Austin when he's down. Just like that, Brett says, I'm a bad guy. Brett says he's found a vein of reality in his change to being a bad guy, chastising the American fans for not believing in good guys or right and wrong anymore. Brett says the truth is he doesn't see the fan side of it and that he can sew that into his storyline. Brett says he doesn't have a problem with being the bad guy as long as he doesn't sell out to his true fans and become a slimy bad guy wrestler just to sell tickets. Brett says he's learned that this isn't just a wrestling show.
Right. It's a bit of a funny one. That I quite like the sentiment overall that he's kind of resistant to it and he's got the pride in the character. But it's a tough one, isn't it? That he's willing to do it, but... like, he's almost saying that he can't do it quite wholeheartedly, it feels like.
And I guess it just boils down to, like we said earlier on, like how seriously he takes that character.
Yeah.
Like, he just doesn't want to come out and just be a bad guy wrestler and say typical bad guy wrestler things for the sake of Vince wanting him to be a bad guy. He finds, like he says, the seed of kind of truth in that, actually, I don't understand why you're cheering people like Austin and Burmy. Like, what did I ever do? To generate that reaction.
No, I think that side of things is quite clever, but it feels like he's just not prepared. Like, and I get this, like, there's obviously this quite stubborn side to him.
Yeah.
And that he has got, like, these are where kind of my principles are, and I don't want to really deviate from that. But it just feels like he doesn't want to go all in heel, but, like, he's like, I'm willing to do this.
See, I think he did, based on kind of the promos he'd cut, kind of anti-American on TV and stuff. I think he did go full in, especially when they had the kind of, you know, the unique idea which they touch upon, like, I'm a bad guy in America, but I'm a good guy everywhere else.
No, that was really interesting.
The footage of Steve Austin's attack on the knee of Bret Hart on the April 21st, 1997 episode of Raw is War is shown, with the rapturous crowd response that accompanied it. Brett says he was in the middle of the ring pleading for his life, being beaten down by the despicable villain, and the crowd loved every minute of it. Brett being loaded into the ambulance is shown, along with Austin's subsequent attack. Brett says it's one of the best Raw shows the WWF ever did. Yeah, he's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Seen anything like that recently on Raw?
A little bit. One of Bret's anti-American tirades is shown, with Bret saying the American wrestling fans don't respect him and he doesn't respect them and that they can kiss his ass. Bret says it's a unique place for him to be. He's the bad guy in America, but a good guy everywhere else. Bret cutting a promo in Canada to applause is shown. He says in Canada, they still take care of the sick and the old and they have health care. They have gun control and they don't kill each other. He says Canada isn't riddled with racial hatred and across the country they all care for each other. Bret says he's proud to be Canadian and is proud to be their Canadian hero. Bret attacking the Patriot whilst the US national anthem plays is shown before the promo, where Bret says the US is a giant toilet bowl ends the segment. In the back of a car, Bret says he didn't mean it when he said if you were going to give the United States an enema, you'd stick the hose in Pittsburgh. Someone in the front of the car says Washington, to which Bret says, maybe.
Who is it that says Washington? Can we tell who it is?
No, I presume it's the cameraman or one of the filmmakers or something.
Calendar sounds great.
It does, doesn't it?
It does a good job of selling. Like, is that like Canada's advert?
I don't think Bret Hart coming out on Raw saying all that stuff is probably in any sort of Canadian tourism ads.
Oh, okay. But I did feel that when I reflected back on the Patriot stuff, although, you know, it's kind of more mid-card stuff and the matches, although were kind of passable but not stellar.
Yeah.
It made a lot more sense given this perspective.
Okay.
So I actually feel a bit more positive about the Patriot stuff now.
We're at SummerSlam 1997, prior to Bret's WWF title match with The Undertaker, and we are shown some fans who back Bret and others who don't. One of them is an American who is now supporting Canada. Behind him is a giant inflatable Undertaker, which I'm pretty sure was at the entrance to Access at WrestleMania this year.
I was going to say about that. Like, that looks amazing.
Yeah.
Why don't we have more footage of that?
Right, that guy, though, tell me if this is right or not. He, to me, looked like Edge and Christian rolled into one. Kind of like their early days. Do you not think?
I didn't make that connection, but perhaps I need to go back and watch it.
But also, there was a guy kind of before that who was talking about he was on kind of the pro-American side, and he's like, why don't you like him? It's like, they say we suck. They started it.
Yeah, I know, that's amazing.
So I well done, mate.
One chastises Shawn Michaels for having a belly button ring and posing in Playgirl. Did you know more men read that magazine than women?
I'd heard that somewhere.
Yeah.
Really?
One woman laments the American fans for booing Bret when 9 months ago they were cheering him. She says that Bret inspired her to do many different things with her life. She's now going to school learning computer graphics and credits Bret for this. Paul's looked like she's about to wet himself.
I do love this. Bret Hart sent this woman to college. It's amazing.
I actually thought you'd find this very inspiring, but instead you find it hilarious. Anything?
No, like, to be fair, like, fair enough. But it's just... That is such a stark contrast. You know, Bret's inspired me to go and do, what is it like? Some kind of IT course?
It's like computer graphics.
Computer graphics course. It's just like, yeah, I'm not sure it's a very natural connection.
Can you not join the dots on that one?
just like, when she was going on with the story, it's like, yeah, you like Bret, good. Like, take those characteristics, good, believe it, like, all good stuff. But just then the kind of computer graphics bit.
Yeah, there's Bret Hart, like good morals, good work ethic, good wrestler, good sense of style, nice glasses. I'm going to do IT in college. It is a bit strange.
Yeah. Do you not think it's incredible, though, that, like...
I quite like it because it's an example of the all-out love that people have for some of these characters.
Yeah.
And Bret inspires that in certain people. Even though I think it's a completely bizarre way of being shown...
To be honest, I think you're wrong because Dolph Ziggler inspired me to become a chef.
The Usos inspired me to become a chef.
But yeah, it's like a real powerful ability to inspire that, you know, it's not obviously not just wrestlers, but like footballers or TV personalities or musicians kind of.
Generally speaking, it's more along the lines of, I love this musician so much, I'm going to learn the guitar. Or I love this wrestler so much, I'm going to go wrestling school.
But it's just, she'll stand there kind of having picked up like her diploma, whatever, and she'll be like, thank God for Bret Hart.
Maybe she, you know, a more logical hero would have been like Bill Gates.
But it's, it also like, and like, I know this is kind of terrible stereotyping, but she's like a middle-aged lady who, like, for her, A, to be kind of like inspired directly by Bret Hart again.
You just couldn't make that connection.
No.
I wonder if the other people on the course did. So why are you here? Oh, I really like computers. Why are you here? I like Bret Hart. All right. Nice.
I thought it was inspiring anyway. Bret solemnly talks about how every now and again he'll meet a young kid who wishes he'd changed back to being a good guy and wants him to be the hero again. Bret says he tries to understand it, but he doesn't have any answers to give. And he hopes that when this is all over, he won't have damaged those relationships. If he has, he may feel like he'd made the wrong decision.
That must be kind of crushing, especially as we... I feel like we know from basically your information over the last few years quite well Bret's mindset with things and how he applies himself to bits and bobs and how he takes his character seriously. And I imagine having, after he's been the hero for so long, to have like a 8-year-old kid or something plead with him to turn back to being the good guy.
That must be quite heartbreaking.
Must be quite wrenching for him, yeah.
This is the thing, like, if I were him, like, he still thinks he is the good guy.
But I guess he's talking about, like, an American child that perhaps comes up to him and says, yeah, well, you know, why won't you be the good guy again?
Because he does say that he's, like, 95% of his work is in America, so he was going to be much more American fans than anyone else.
Shawn Michaels' insertion as special guest referee is brought into the story. Bret is shown in the empty Meadowlands, New Jersey, talking to Pat Patterson. Bret worries about losing all his heat to Shawn, and Pat doesn't really offer any reassurances, instead trying to discuss the finish. As announcers Vince McMahon, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler talk about the match, Bret is shown talking backstage with Shawn before Michael's entrance. The ethereal tribal music reappears as The Undertaker and then Bret make their entrances. As the match plays out, we are shown Bruce Pritchard and Gerald Briscoe watching backstage. Bret spits at Shawn and we see Michael's chair shot to The Undertaker, which yields an "oh shit" from Pritchard.
Who else is there? There's somebody else there.
I think it's Jimmy Corderas, isn't it? It's one of the refs.
Okay.
Michaels counts the three and Bret Hart wins the WWF World title for the fifth and final time. Backstage, Bret unlaces his boots as Blade holds the title belt while a moody acoustic country song plays. Bret is photographed with his title, son and a Canadian flag. Bret trains in a gym as the song continues. Bret's training partner suggests he has another 10 years of wrestling left, but Bret says despite the perception of him being a lifer, he can't wait to get out. It'll be like the Shawshank Redemption, getting out, staying out, and leading a normal existence.
I like that. That's a movie reference I got. Just during this, I've got to say a few things. Firstly, going back to the SummerSlam, I remembered how awesome the end of that match was.
Yes.
Because that was brilliant. But also was kind of thinking, I would like to hear Taker's voice in this somewhere. I think he'd have quite a good perspective, because I know you don't never really hear anything from him, but I'd assume he's quite even-handed. He seems to be kind of...
But he doesn't break character.
Certainly not at this stage.
Like, never does he. Apart from that time where he said, yes.
I think he said that in character.
but it was such a weird warping of the character.
Yeah, I agree.
But everything else is very much, I'm an Undertaker, I make coffins, I can control the lights. That's it. You know, so you don't hear him talk in any interviews or anything, do you?
Not at this time, really.
Do you think you'll see Taker doing some now?
We discussed that as part of our WrestleMania piece, so we'll leave that there.
Okay.
Bret says that being gone a lot has been unfair to his wife, Julie, and that he can't say he's been the greatest husband over the last 14 years. If you want backup of that, read his book. Bret plays WrestleMania the arcade game with his kids, who try and tell him what buttons to press.
It looks pretty good.
Yeah, well, it's the one before in your house.
Yeah.
This scene reminded me, and I almost wonder if the scene in The Wrestler is taken from this.
All right.
You know, when he's in the, like, caravan thing playing the NES game with the kids and he doesn't know what buttons to press, and then they're like, can't we play COD or something? I thought there was something very similar about that scene. Bret says he doesn't know how Julie ever put up with him for being gone so long. Julie is asked if she's looking forward to the day Bret hangs up his boots, and Julie responds, I've been waiting for that since he was 25, Paul. She's sure he'll always be involved in wrestling somehow. Julie says she's had enough and she thinks it's time to be normal.
It's quite interesting to get this perspective of wrestling, the kind of the part that you'd never really see or hear.
Yeah, that you kind of, you don't really consider, you know, these people that are on the road 300 days a year out of 365 or whatever it is, there is a wife and children at home.
Yeah.
That presumably he only sees on those rare occasions he goes home or on the events that are somewhere near to where he lives.
Yeah. Mm.
As the D-Generation X entrance video plays, a caption on screen tells us that Vince is losing the war for TV ratings against Turner's WCW. Vince is now taking the WWF in a new direction with a new star, Shawn Michaels. The promo where Michaels' group is named is shown, with Shawn throwing to footage of the Canadian flag shoved up his nose. Helmsley claiming his penis is massive is also included.
Rick Rude and China, like, they have completely kind of...
blank faces.
Blank faces to that. Never crack a smile.
That's pretty much their role?
Yeah.
Do you feel like they should have sold how big his penis was?
But the thing is, like, what you've got is you've got Shawn Michaels and Triple H who are having lots of fun and very expressive, and then you've got those two that are just kind of just, like, don't show any emotion.
They're kind of like the hired muscle, though, aren't they? That's their role, they're kind of bodyguards.
But I'd have expected them to join in with the shenanigans a little bit more.
Do you think it would have demystified China's character at this point if she started making big sort of, like, dick gestures with her hands or something?
Maybe that's why they didn't do that.
Brett says he doesn't know what Vince McMahon is thinking. He perhaps asks the question. What was wrestling thinking? And can't imagine him coming up with these ideas. Brett says he wishes he could be in the room and ask them if they're nuts. Brett says the WWF has become smut TV. Sounds like a channel you watch.
Smut TV. That's the thing is, I like Brett, but I happen to agree with the direction it's going in.
We moved to Madison Square Garden on September 22nd, 2 months before the showdown in Montreal. Shawn Michaels is shown in his underpants, playing around with Brett's son Blade at ringside. Michaels pins Blade, presumably reluctant to put any member of the Hart family over.
Oh, I loved this, though. This was another one of those bits, because he's wearing the Hitman shades, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
And it makes Shawn Michaels seem like a really kind of almost cool uncle type thing, where he's my cool wrestling uncle, and he's sort of entertaining the kids, and it's not really the Shawn Michaels that we're used to talking about. I quite liked it.
No, I thought this showed a very human side of Shawn Michaels, but also, it's interesting that the headbangers have clearly got sick of Blade. Right, go and bother Shawn.
We're told on this night, Vince McMahon tells Brett he wants out of their 20-year contract. Brett arrives home and discusses this with Julie, claiming Vince told him the company was in financial peril and that Brett would be doing him a favour by leaving. Julie doesn't believe it, saying that Vince came to their house a year ago and begged Brett to stay. Whilst we are shown Vince having makeup applied, audio plays of the Jim Ross interview with Vince, where Vince claims he regretted signing the 20-year deal and that Brett had used Turner to leverage himself in that position. Vince says he listened to all of the people around him who told him not to let Brett go, and he's sorry that he did. A slightly staged feeling scene airs, where Brett enters the kitchen to speak to Julie, saying that he just spoke with Vince. Brett sits down at a table and begins reading from a notebook detailing the reasons Vince has given him as to why Vince is letting him go. Brett says he has to think about everything and asks the cameraman to cut their filming off for a little while.
Thank you, because I was going a bit insane about this, because I got to this stage watching it and I thought, this feels very unnatural. I mean, you guys obviously know much more about the kind of the insides of how a documentary is made, but presumably they're kind of like, oh, that was interesting, but we weren't filming that right, or the lighting's bad, there's a shadow, there's that kind of thing, or the audio's out.
To me, this scene felt like, we need to tell this aspect of the story, let's have you come into the kitchen. I might be wrong, but that's kind of how it felt.
The camera's set up on you, you walk in there, you'll sit there, then we get the shot.
It's highly unlikely that, especially at this stage, with what they're filming with, they'd just be filming all the time. Like, opportunistically, at this point in their house, you know, it would have been, we're waiting until after the phone call, and then we'll see what it's about, and we need to get that, we'll redo that now, because they're on a cost.
Brett lays in an empty wrestling ring and says that WCW has called him. He had thought their deal had fallen through, but they've asked what it would take to bring him there. Brett says he has every reason to leave now, but he still wants to give Vince the benefit of the doubt. Brett says he asked Vince to talk him into staying. He didn't want to talk money, he wanted to talk ideas. Vince told Brett he had no ideas for him, and Brett then realised the horrible predicament he was in. He went from number one good guy to being number one bad guy, and now that job has been given to Shawn Michaels. How could he be a good guy again? Brett has bashed the American people, where he performs 95% of the time, and he's now stuck in purgatory. He can't be a great good guy, and he can't be a great bad guy. He's stuck with nothing. Brett says Vince has sabotaged his career. as Brett regales this dilemma. Footage airs from the end of the Raw is War before WrestleMania 13, where Brett tore into Vince whilst the steel cage is dismantled around him. Back at home, Brett says he's faxed his contract to WCW and he's heartbroken and disappointed to leave the WWF. He says he's watched his career end in about 20 seconds.
They use a lot of cage footage to kind of indicate that he's feeling trapped.
Yep. Yeah, I thought that was very deliberate. You picked up on that. Well done. Burden of insight now.
Thank you. Everything happens for a reason, apparently.
I don't think it puts a very good cast iron reason in the plot line of the documentary as to why he's going. I think it's a lovely point that he's stuck in some sort of weird limbo between things where he's like, I can't be a bad guy and I can't be a good guy. Well, in actual fact, he can. He can't be the number one bad guy and he can't be the number one good guy. That's the issue.
Yeah, and I think that's where I was about to ask you. Like, there is something for him there, but I guess he doesn't feel either it's worth it or it's at his level.
He's at the top, and he's been at the top of the pile for a while. And in order to go back to being a good guy, he's always going to go underneath Austin.
Yeah.
And he knows that he's not going to be the number one good guy. And he can't be the number one bad guy. He's a bad guy at the minute, but he can't be as much as a dickhead as Shawn Michaels. So he's not going to be the number one bad guy. He's going to have to take his position and lower it down a peg or two, and that's probably something that's unacceptable for him.
But I'm going to counter that argument, though. We saw him do it. In 95, he was positioned under Shawn and Diesel the entire year, and he seemed okay with it.
But I mean, we're in a different position now, and it's been very turbulent, and he's had to do lots of things that he wasn't comfortable with. And he sees that because he's been not forced but encouraged into these directions, it's something that he's going to have to do, and he's going to have to take a hit on this, and that's not where he wants to go with it.
Yeah, I mean, looking back now, and I'm sure we probably touched on this last episode, but do you think Vince knowingly sabotaged Brett in terms of... Like, I know you're saying you've gone back and you've had a bit of a reappreciation of the Patriot stuff, but he's the champion and he's positioned deliberately under Shawn.
Yeah, and Vince is certainly smart enough to do this as a far-sighted plan of where he wants to take it in order to really cut the loss that he's going to have to make. It's certainly possible, but it might not be quite as clear-cut as that.
Brett says 4 more weeks and he's out of the WWF, and he's been asked to keep his leaving a secret, but he's not going to stay quiet on his feelings about the product. An episode of Off the Record with Michael Landsberg is shown, with Landsberg claiming that the real fight is off-screen between Brett and Vince over the direction of the company. A clip from December 1997 is inserted into this, which shows Sable wearing pretty much nothing.
Nice.
A Brett interview is shown where he claims that the WWF is not for kids and has become more raunchy and sexual. He says the show is about sex, and people don't watch wrestling for sex.
True, they watch it for wrestling.
Brett says his kids don't watch the show anymore. Landsberg introduces Vince's response, which I think has been inserted here. It's a promo from After Survivor Series, which we'll discuss next episode. Landsberg interviews the Wrestling Observer's Dave Meltzer and Paul Boudreaux from Simon Fraser University. Boudreaux says that there's some sleight of hand going on here. You can tell complex stories that still appeal to kids, and you can discuss moral relativism without resorting to racist or sexual slurs. Meltzer says it's Vince's way of justifying anything he does at the time. If there's no good and evil, nothing's a problem. Mm. A third interviewee, Henry Jenkins from MIT in Boston, says that this is not exclusive to the WWF. Freddy Krueger costumes are marketed to kids, and that Vince throwing out the rulebook has made for a much more exciting WWF.
This is a really interesting discussion, I think. Like, does this exist anywhere, to your knowledge?
I've not looked for it, but maybe we'll have a check on YouTube to see if we can find the full episode.
If that's like a 60-minute discussion between that lot, I think it's really interesting insights that they're all going to have on what's happening at the time.
I felt like MIT guy was you in a mask.
Why?
Because I think he quite liked the idea of it becoming a bit sexy and raunchy.
What did you make of that, though, the idea that you can still tell complex stories without the smut? You can still do not necessarily straight good and evil, but it doesn't have to contain the content and the direction that the company's going? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Is that too complex a question?
I think you can.
I think you can, but it's more effort to do it like that, isn't it? And that's the thing, it's easier to do it. It's easier to get ratings with stronger violence and more kind of... raunch your product.
Yeah, it's basically like the dark side of the force. easier, quicker, more seductive.
What?
It's a reference that Scrivens isn't going to get.
But I'll be honest, I kind of agreed with what Meltzer thought there.
Yeah, that
it's just an excuse, isn't it?
Yeah, that if you kind of go with that point of view of saying there's no good and evil, it's all shades of grey, then yeah, any character or any storyline you come up with is justified in that sense. Yeah. Because your characters aren't supposed to be good, your characters aren't supposed to be evil. We moved to the night before Survivor Series where we began the documentary. Brett says he went public with his feelings about the direction of the WWF, so Vince leaked out that Brett was leaving for the money, that he sold out. The crowd in Detroit, Michigan chants, "You sold out" at Brett. Brett hugs and slaps hands with some fans as he leaves the arena. Brett says he was becoming as emotional as the fans were. Inside a limousine, the Honky Tonk Man says things have become messed up. Random.
It's really odd. We must have an opinion from the Honky Tonk Man now. He's just found rockabilly, for God's sake.
Maybe that's what he's talking about. Well, he's just cut it in.
He's just lost rockabilly. That's why he's saying things have become so messed up. Brett, sat next to the president of WWF Canada, Carl DeMarco, says that the situation with Sean isn't great. He expresses his anger with Sean for saying that Stu is dead on television, which irks Jim the Anvil Neidhart, who presumably wasn't listening.
And also you wouldn't want to irk.
Yes, true. Brett says that Vince sat he and Sean down and told them to really shoot with each other. Brett says that Vince wanted him to allege that Sean was gay, something that Sean was happy with Brett doing. Brett says afterwards he felt really uncomfortable doing it. Brett says it was meant he was doing the same thing to Sean that he was asking Sean not to do to him. Brett says it's built to the place where the hero has to prevail.
That was quite interesting. In that, like, that sort of mindset is, I have these sort of standards and I don't want you saying this sort of stuff about me. But you're also being told by someone that you should say this sort of stuff about him, which you don't want to do. But the other person's saying, yeah, go on, please say that stuff about me. So he's having to do something that he morally disagrees with and doesn't want happening to him, which is an interesting dilemma for him to be in.
And I think we did pick up on that last time when we discussed the build to the match, and I seem to remember kind of interacting with a couple of people on Twitter who were happy that we kind of picked up on that and kind of chastised Brett. And from the perspective of being a Brett fan, it's good to kind of go back and watch this and see that actually he was uncomfortable with making those gay slurs. That it wasn't something he necessarily wanted to do, but Vince had encouraged him and Sean was okay with it, and that's the direction they wanted to take it, so he kind of did it.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it doesn't necessarily make it right.
It doesn't make it right, but from a kind of personal perspective, it's good to know that it wasn't something where he was like, yeah, I get to go out and say he's gay and I'm just going to bash him for being gay and I'm really happy about it.
Okay.
At home, Brett says he talked to Vince, who told him he has to lose to Shawn Michaels in Montreal. Vince doesn't want Brett showing up on WCW with his belt. Brett told Vince he'd never do that and that he'd lose the belt, just not in Canada. Vince insisted he lose in Montreal. Brett says Vince told him he could leave any way he wanted, and now he's having this thrown at him. Brett says he'd never said no to Vince McMahon ever. Brett tells Julie he feels like he's compromised enough and that he has reasonable creative control for the last 30 days of his contract. Julie asks Brett, what if something happens regardless? Brett says he doesn't have to worry about the referee, as he spoke with Earl Hebner, who swore on his kids' lives that he'd never let anything happen.
He had a great slow-mo shot of Earl's face there as well.
I can trust Earl.
Brett says he can trust Earl. Brett discusses the situation with Stu and says that he feels it would be a blow to Canada if he lost. Okay, even I'll concede you're taking yourself a bit too seriously there.
I thought the next bit was really interesting because going back to the kind of the father theme here, I think he gets vindication from his dad.
Well, yes, but Stu wonders why Vince would ever want Brett to leave his company, as Brett had always done such a good job for Vince. Brett says he's missed 2 shows in 14 years for Vince and that this is a modest request, especially in light of the creative control aspect of his contract.
Mm. So, yeah, for me, that kind of felt a pretty big moment because I know the kind of, like, it's not necessarily the real storyline, but for this kind of underlying thing about kind of this kind of parental relationship part of things, that for me is a huge moment where it's like, I think Brett then is starting to see it. He almost can justify putting himself on the same kind of step of ladder as his dad.
Do you think then if he'd have gone in real life, say, and had this conversation with Stu, and Stu would have gone, he's the boss, you should probably do what he says, Brett might have turned around and gone, oh, all right then. But because he went to, you know, he's got these two father figures in his life, one his actual father, and he's gone to his father, and his father says, well, you've always done a good job for him. Like, why is he being this way with you? Brett then felt, like you say, vindicated in his point of view that, no, I shouldn't be doing what he asks me to.
Mm. Be interesting. There's probably an alternate reality where the one difference is in it that Stu says, just lose, and this never happens.
Get your portal gun.
Yeah.
Outside the Survivor Series, a fan with a megaphone pledges his allegiance to Brett. Brett signs autographs for fans while others sing his praises. One says Brett will always be his hero.
So in that bit where he's signing the autographs, who's that kid with the headset in the background? Is that one of his kids?
I didn't spot a kid with a headset.
Yeah, there is. Like, he's kind of sitting there like the flipping organiser of the event, yes, with like a headset on,
yeah,
just looking at him.
Yeah, he looks like he's like some kind of security guy or some kind of manager.
But he's 12.
But probably less than that, probably 11.
We cut back to the opening of the documentary with Brett walking down the hotel corridor. Once again, Brett says he'd rather blow his brains out than lose to Sean. Brett says he'd rather they rape him in the middle of the ring, but Brett says he won't let them do that. Brett says this whole thing has been hard.
Yeah, that was something, again, that I didn't like.
You feel the terminology is too extreme?
It's just not appropriate.
Yeah, the company's gone in a different direction, but it's not gone that far yet.
You can't say that.
We move to 3 hours before the match, though we hear audio from the bout of Jim Ross speculating that this will be Bret Hart's last match with the WWF. Backstage, Julie Hart talks with Sonny, who says she didn't hear anything until Friday and was shocked. Julie says she's in shock, and Sonny says Bret not being there will be a huge void. Chains and Mosh throw one of Bret's kids about.
So would you, again, I've not got kids. Scribbins, would you trust Chains and Mosh to lob baby Scribbins around?
Yeah.
Okay.
You would. But well, bearing in mind the coordination we've seen from those two people.
Oh, no, they're probably strong enough.
Julie speaks with Dave Hebner, who says he'll miss Brett. Sonny hides behind a corner to chase after Blade Hart and wrestles with him in a corridor.
Lucky bastard.
I think Sonny comes across quite well in that. That's just kind of like a nice...
Yeah.
Nice moment, I thought.
Imagine being like 8, 9 years old and just hanging out with Sonny.
Yeah, one of my resounding memories of this, or feelings on this, is that Blade had a fucking lucky few years, actually, because he got to like hang out with all the wrestlers and chat on pretty good terms with Vince McMahon and be fondled by Sonny, and there's all these good things that happened.
I'm not sure he was fondled by Sonny.
Okay, rewatch it.
I don't know, he goes to WCW, but maybe he just gets the same relationship with Kimberly.
Yeah, hangs out with Goldberg.
Julie says her kids have grown up in the WWF and that it's funny hugging and saying goodbye to everyone. Julie says she'll never see these people again. They'll just be a memory. I found this particularly affecting. The filmmaker chooses to interview Blade, who's kind of sat in a corner next to a radiator. And he says that he knows everybody there and he doesn't understand why his dad's leaving.
Yeah.
Thought that was quite sad.
It's also quite interesting that... I don't know, probably it's very difficult actually for him to talk, bearing in mind that Blade will probably tell everyone what's going on. But like, you'd think that he'd want to try and perhaps explain a bit more to him about, I don't know, it probably is just very difficult because he might talk to the people.
Yeah, I know that Blade would be upset because all this cool stuff that I just mentioned, that's gone. And, you know, this man, Eric Bischoff, we're going to his company.
Hmm.
Well, to be fair, like, today, I'm sure if he wanted, he could get on Skype and, you know...
pay his $20 or whatever it is.
And Sonny would do something similar?
She's not Skyping anymore, because she's back on Twitter. All she now seems to post about is Snapchat.
You covered this last episode, Adam.
Yeah.
Stop banging on about it.
Do you have to pay for Snapchat?
Adam, if you want to find out, just find out.
Brett asks his kids to say hello to Vince before telling them to go mess around while he talks with his boss. They head to a dressing room marked Vince's office, which suspiciously also seems to be marked women's dressing room.
Right. I'm pretty sure it's just the corridor and all the rooms are down that corridor.
Yeah. No, because it doesn't say male dressing room anywhere. It says Vince's office, ladies' dressing room.
Yeah.
Right. There was like some pictures on the top, like... What did you make of, like, the decoration?
Spartan chariots.
Yeah.
It was clearly just something out of clip art that when someone was printing off the labels in Word, thought, that'll look cool.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
It's just like, to think, Vince just chose it for himself. Ah, I'm going to have that.
Possibly. A caption on screen tells us that Vince and Brett are meeting to discuss how tonight's match will end, but that Brett is wearing a wire so we can hear their conversation.
Why haven't they done this more?
Brett tells Vince he feels betrayed, and Vince says he does too, a little bit. Vince says Ted Turner has come between them, that's it, and that he can never tell Brett how appreciative he is of everything Brett has done for him. Brett says that he never wanted to leave and asks Vince what he wants to do that night. Vince says, "I'm open to anything." Brett says he just wants to get through today and tomorrow. He'll forfeit the title and leave in a nice way. Brett says he thinks they should do a schmoz tonight, and Vince says he assumes it'll be a run-in, but he's open to anything. Like I said before, I'm determined that this ends up the right way, the WWF owner adds before walking off.
I like the term schmoz. They use it quite a lot towards the end of this show.
It's sort of an overarching term to describe any sort of shenanigans.
I think it just means like DQ, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is interesting that they've chosen a longer word to say than DQ for an abbreviation.
So, this conversation then.
I think to be fair, Vince comes across okay.
Apart from the fact we now know for definite, because, you know, Adam, obviously one of the questions you raised quite consistently last episode was, we're taking Brett's word for it. We now know Vince is a liar.
Yeah?
What's he lied about?
Well, he says they're going to do a schmoz. He says he's all right with it, doesn't he? Doesn't,
no, he says
I'm open to anything.
Yeah, yeah. So he doesn't categorically say that that's going to happen.
No, he says he thinks it'll be a run-in. That's what Vince says.
He also says, I'm determined for this to end the right way.
Yeah, but to Vince, it did end the right way.
Hmm.
But he doesn't mean I'm determined for this to end the way that you want it to end. He says it's going to end the
right
way.
Yeah, but that's what's implied.
But, yeah, I know, but it's different between implication and being explicit. Okay.
No, he's lying to him. I'm sorry, he's lying to him.
But it's Vince's smart language.
Hang on. But for me, right, the way that I view this is, I'm viewing this as the fact that at this moment in time, the Screwjob bit actually hasn't happened yet.
Well, it hasn't, no.
So I view this as, I don't know who's lying about anything. He just comes across okay.
Well,
they've already decided.
They decide early in the afternoon, don't they? This is, like they say, so this is as the pay-per-view starting around that kind of time where Vince meets with Brett to say, what do you want to do? Vince, you know, Sean, Hunter, all those guys, they know what they're planning on doing. But then when Vince meets with Brett, he says, I'm open to anything. I'm determined for this to end the right way and whatever you want to do.
I'll stop antagonising you now. Yes, Vince is lying.
Well, something interesting that I noticed is that a couple of times after there's phone call bits in this documentary, you see Brett with his book.
Yes.
So I think, I do wonder if he has just like very meticulous notes on everything.
I think he does, yes.
Says and done, which is perhaps why he does do quite detailed stuff and knows a lot of the stories.
It's also why his book's 700 pages.
Yeah.
Is it the longest biography that you've got?
I would assume so.
You wait till I do mine. He'll have a cracking story. Do you want another cracking story? Just...
Hang on, before you do that, I'll make the point that you'll never finish your autobiography, but go on.
What, because I can't pronounce any of the words or spell them?
Because you'll just lose interest halfway through. Now, however, if you want to write an autobiography and you agree with me to pay me to write it for you, it'll get finished, but tell
okay,
your story.
Let's do that.
I'll be your ghostwriter.
No, I was in shock of all shocks, Sainsbury's the other week, and I went in there, I was kind of just doing a few bits and pieces. I just had N'Golo with me. Actually, it was just me and N'Golo, just the boys. Doing a bit of shopping, and I went around and kind of thinking, oh, need some shower gel. And I was after some, I usually just actually put it on the floor of the kind of shower tray, but I actually thought, no, I'll get some that hangs up this time. And there were some Radox ones that run off for £1, and they had quite a few different flavours. So I kind of thought, well, this, like, it's like orange and something. It kind of sounds quite nice. I'll have a sniff. So I kind of open it up and I go to have a sniff, but it's got one of those like little valve bits in, obviously, to stop it dripping. So, you know, you just kind of like squeeze it a little bit just so you get the scent. I just squeeze it a little bit too hard and it just shot right up my nose.
Is that the end of the story?
I feel like that the lead up to that story was overly complicated.
I'm also pretty certain that while we were at WrestleMania 33, you messaged Tom Canning saying, I've got a cracking story about shower gel, tell Stuart.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Right, okay.
That's the story. What did you think it was going to be? Come up with a better shower gel story based on shower gel.
Brett then talks with Pat Patterson as we see Vince in makeup and Earl Hebner being mic'd up, looking a bit guilty. Brett then speaks with Julie and Davey Boy Smith and says it's okay, they're going to do a disqualification. Brett narrates saying that Vince has finally agreed that he didn't have to lose the belt and that he could leave with his head up. Stu Hart is shown watching the show at home. We see the Vince and Slaughter interview with Michael Cole, where Vince says he doesn't know who will win.
Hang on, that bit about watching the show at home also was a bit weird, wasn't it?
What do you mean?
Well, you wouldn't film him watching it at home because you'd have all your cameras at the show.
Well, obviously it's inserted, isn't it? They might have an extra camera at Stu's house. You never know.
They might do, but it felt a little bit disingenuous.
It's time for the match. Michaels and Brett's entrances are shown, and we see their brawl prior to the match officially beginning. The ethereal tribal music returns, with snippets of Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler's commentary thrown in. The music here really starts to remind me of the opening of Lateralis by Tool, which is an excellent song and an excellent album. As we get to the finish of the match where Earl Hebner takes his bump, the audio is spliced in of Brett planning the match finish with Pat Patterson. We hear Brett and Pat's plans for how the match is supposed to end, except Sean applies the sharpshooter to Bret Hart and Earl Hebner calls for the bell. As we see a replay of the ending in slow motion, black and white, Brett tells us that as he reached for Sean's leg, he could hear someone yelling, "Ring the bell, ring the bell." Brett says he knew it was Vince McMahon and he realised they had screwed him. They really screwed him, the lousy bastards. We see Brett spit in Vince's face and hear the crowd chanting bullshit as the show finishes and Michaels and company disappear backstage. Brett gives them the double bird and stands in the ring in shock and disbelief. We hear Brett and Vince speaking earlier in the evening, planning the DQ finish. "Whatever you want," says Vince. Julie Hart looks on as we see Owen Hart and Jim Neidhart in the ring with Brett. We see a quick shot of the fan we saw earlier who says she was inspired by the Hitman. We see Brett trash TV monitors and leave the arena surrounded by staff. Blade is the last of the group to go through the curtain.
Interesting section. I think the kind of a few bits, just like random bits that stood out to me though, was Vince talks to Briscoe quickly. And presumably tells him to go after Sean.
Yeah.
So I'd always assume that that had been kind of, that kind of bit of the end would have been quite thoroughly planned.
Yeah.
But it was probably a lot more thrown together than I might have imagined.
Or Jerry Briscoe is a bit inept and Vince had to go, "You're supposed to go with Sean. See you later."
Well, it might be. But I liked my version. It's kind of interesting just to see like a few different camera angles and just yeah, get a bit of a different feel for it.
I kind of expected to see a bit more than this. We see more than obviously you see on Survivor Series, but the cameras must have been rolling for quite a while. And it's very cut together to make it very quick. But I think a bit more of that footage would have been interesting to put it. But then again, maybe it would have made it a bit plodding for what's supposed to be quite a quick and dramatic climax to it.
I also thought it was quite interesting about Blaze. I felt really sorry for Blaze going through at the end.
Yeah, like him being the last person to walk through the curtain.
But just completely probably confused about what's happened.
Yeah.
But also the amount of staff around Brett and why that was. And I don't think any of those would be in it. I don't, whether they were just around him because he'd been trashing stuff, if they were around him because they wanted to do that for his protection for any reason, or...
To me, they looked more like staff for the arena than WWF staff.
Yeah.
I have to reappraise my, you know, evaluation of the whole Montreal Screwjob and say, who's the real victim? It's Blade.
Henry Godwin, after all.
He had a fucking horrible night.
Yeah, I think he did have a horrible night.
Apart from that bit where Sonny touched him.
Yeah, it started off promising, ended badly.
Backstage, Brett speaks with Julie and says, that piece of shit has locked himself in his office. Brett heads to his locker room, Blade in tow. Michaels and Helmsley are shown heading in that direction. Brett asks, "Sean, you weren't in on that?" Off screen, Michaels says, "With God as my witness, my hands are clean on this one. I swear to God, I gave him the belt and came back here. I won't have any part of this."
But it took it. He didn't answer instantaneously, did he? There was a bit of a pause before Sean spoke. But I also thought it was interesting, were they in the same dressing room then for the whole time?
Yeah.
Because I thought they came out of different dressing rooms when they did the...
Yeah, well, they would be on TV, wouldn't they? Yeah.
Okay.
Or different entrances to the same one, perhaps.
Okay. But yeah, I thought it was kind of quite interesting that they'd just be getting changed next to each other.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it seems like.
Yeah.
I wish we could have seen Sean's face while he said this.
Yeah.
It's interesting hearing his voice and, you know, and he is kind of bullshit, and we know that.
Well, he's also a liar.
Yes, but I imagine that he would put in a great acting performance, so I would quite like to have seen his face.
Well, he could have oversold it.
I would have also liked to seen if Triple H was standing there as well.
And, well, Triple H is outside, isn't he?
Is he outside?
I think he's outside, isn't he?
Interesting.
But yeah, Brett's version of the story has Sean blubbering and crying. I don't know if that comes across in Sean's speech. I think you can kind of hear his voice slightly cracking, but his voice is normally cracking.
Mm. Yeah, it doesn't sound like he's really in sort of floods of tears, but he's there during the altercation with Vince, isn't he?
Yeah.
And is that the point where he starts crying?
Possibly. Vince enters the locker room and Brett advises the filmmakers to turn their camera off.
That's a shame.
A large number of people wait in the corridor outside the locker room, including Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Julie Hart has figured everything out already. What happened? Did you guys have a meeting this afternoon and decide the whole thing? No, I swear, says Helmsley meekly. Don't give me that shit, responds Julie, because you guys knew it. You knew it from the very beginning, all of you. I swear to God, I knew nothing, protests Helmsley. Swear to God all you want, but someday God is going to strike you down, Julie retorts. That hasn't happened quite yet.
Well, I was really pleased about this bit.
Yeah.
I was really like, go get him. But it was interesting that, because you've got, presumably that would have been probably fairly tactical, Hunter being out there in case anything kicked off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Outside, so that was perhaps pre-planned. But also, I mean, he was very much kind of like head down.
Looking like a guilty child.
Yeah, looking, yeah.
But yeah, she carries on. She tells Helmsley, you had just as much to do with it as the rest of them, which we obviously know to be true.
Yeah.
It's so strange to see the man we know in 2017 stood there, his head lowered, being completely dressed down by Brett's wife, who knows that he's lying to her.
Well, she's completely got it.
Yeah.
Completely got it.
Oh, she's worked the whole thing out.
And just that kind of, I don't know, is that just women's intuition, like, I don't know, I'm not a lady.
She's just worked it out. I mean, we saw her ask Brett before, and then even after Brett has the meeting with Vince, she's still like, oh, I'm not sure. So she knows they're going to do that.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, to kind of just see her cut this promo on Triple H while he... Well, it is, isn't it?
It is amazing.
To be honest, it's probably one of my favourite promos.
Because one of the things that I was quite surprised about, and I don't know... You don't necessarily get a sense for how long it is between the event happening and them getting backstage here, whether it's a couple of minutes, whether it's a kind of more extended period of time.
I think it's a matter of minutes, yeah. Okay.
Because Brett seemed not calm, but...
Shock, isn't it?
Yeah, it might be. But she's got the anger that I wanted to see.
Yeah.
You know, that was a good, genuine reaction.
She asks those assembled if they're going to go back to the hotel and have a big party and a laugh about the whole thing. But for her and her family, it really sucks. Julie tells Hunter, someday what goes around comes around. Again, not happened quite yet.
Good promo. Don't see that happening.
Yeah. Ultimately, there was no payoff. Yeah.
They need to bring her character back. I mean, just like very randomly, like next WrestleMania.
Julie Hart versus Triple H.
It doesn't have to be like, you know, but maybe like Triple H can have a match and she could orchestrate I've not done it for a while, boys. She could orchestrate some kind of distraction in the finish.
And how would you best sum that up in a word?
Shenanigans.
Screw job. There we go. Owen moves Julie down the corridor and tells the cameraman he doesn't want to be filmed. The camera re-enters the locker room and we cut to Brett, sat on a bench, a smirk on his face. The filmmaker asks Brett what happened, and Brett says that somehow Vince ran into his hand. Brett says he drilled Vince as hard as he could and knocked him out. We see a groggy Vince leaving the scene, followed by his son Shane and other WWF officials. Brett says that when the smoke cleared, it was the right thing to do. Punch Vince one time and let it go. Hmm. Brett says it was a Stu Hart judgment call.
Vince looks like he's been hit with a winch or something, and he like heavily concussed, or like he's had 12 or 13 pints. And he's just kind of like sloshing down the corridor with this real vacant expression on his face. It is fantastic. But he's not that badly beaten up,
no.
Actually.
Well, it's just one punch, isn't it?
Yeah, but... Like, Bret Hart's a big guy.
He looks huge. Like,
yeah,
you've got some real appreciation for how big a dude he is in that.
And he punched him in the face as hard as he could. I think Vince probably... He could have come across worse.
Yeah.
The worst injury was his ankle, right?
Yeah, the story is Gerald Briscoe, like, steps on it and he breaks his ankle.
What?
Yeah. I'm not sure how true this is, but apparently while, like, the whole thing's going on and, like, Jerry Briscoe jumps on... kind of the situation to try and prise them apart, and he steps on Vince's ankle, causing Vince to like break it.
That adds a whole sort of slapstick quality to the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they should have filmed that.
How fascinating is it that in the most infamous moment, let's say, in wrestling history, and there just happens to be a film crew there that captures all of this?
I wish they'd have captured more, but yes, it is fascinating.
Yeah, I would have liked more of this.
More Julie Hart promos, please.
Yeah. I wanted to see the punch and Jerry Briscoe snapping Vince's ankle.
What did you make to... Like you said, Bret Hart's got a bit of a smirk.
Yeah.
About punching him. What do you make to that?
It's a little victory, isn't it? It's... Like we say, I think he's in shock at that point, and no matter what he does, he comes out the loser. Like, he has lost this situation. There's no denying that. So his little victory, I guess, is whacking Vince.
I just think it's slightly odd that he kind of just celebrates that so much. I could get the kind of, like, having a bit of kind of feel good about it and kind of a bit of getting that pentagram progression out. But I don't know if it's something I'd want to celebrate. I don't know, I've not been in that situation.
How many people have assaulted Vince McMahon? We know that Bret Hart and Nails have. Is there anyone else that's quite a famous one?
We'll have to do some research.
That is, you know, it's quite a risky business, being the leader of a wrestling organisation. Yeah.
Well, there's that amazing story, isn't there, that I think Brett told at WrestleCon of Vince getting drunk and demanding all the tag teams do their finishers on him. And the Legion of Doom do like a really shoddy version of the Doomsday Device. And then Anvil's like, the Hart Foundation would have done it.
Yeah.
So they do. And Vince loves it.
Yeah. Hands down, one of my favourite wrestling stories of all time.
Back at home, Brett lays looking up at the ceiling in his wrestling ring. We again see footage of Vince being interviewed by Jim Ross. Vince says it's too bad that a 14-year relationship was destroyed because one member of that relationship forgot they were in the sports entertainment business and forgot where he came from. Bret Hart screwed Bret Hart, and he can look in the mirror and know that, says Vince. Bret says that Vince has always looked at wrestlers like circus animals, taking them out back and shooting them when they were done. Bret says in his case, his demands put the power back in the wrestler's hands somewhat, and Bret says maybe that was it. He became too powerful and Vince needed to tear him down. Maybe, Bret says, Vince just wanted to prove he could still do it. Bret says he'll never know, but he does know Vince was wrong. Bret sits alone in his ring, thinking.
Good metaphor on the circus animal thing. I mean, that is really interesting. And all these massive stars that have appeared throughout the years in wrestling promotions, and they have their moment of glory that might last for 10 years, but then what happens to them afterwards? Like, the business doesn't often keep paying for them. It's quite sad.
We go back to the Michael Landsberg show, where Paul Boudre compares Bret Hart to Hamlet. Hamlet found himself in a world where he could find no moral values, but he still had personal integrity in keeping his word and doing what he promises he will do. And as such, he is a good man, even if he is in a bad world. Quite a lofty comparison
there.
Yeah. Do you see the comparison?
Not seen Hamlet.
Or read it.
Okay. Bret watches Raw is War and sees the segment from November 24th, 1997, where Sean brings out the midget version of him after promising the real Bret Hart. Bret glances at Julie, who looks equally as unimpressed by Michaels and Helmsley's antics. Bret is shown walking outside with his father. Bret says that it's almost a fitting end to the Hitman character, as he never sold out and never lost his integrity. Bret Hart says he came home and he's fine, but that they murdered the Hitman character. Stu and Bret walk towards their house, and a caption on the screen tells us that Bret Hart now wrestles for Ted Turner's WCW as the film ends and the credits roll.
What did you make for the finish?
I guess I don't know how you end it, really. Like, in terms of the storytelling in this movie, the villain wins. Like, that's the end, isn't it? Vince turns out to be the villain, and he gets one over on the hero. So I guess the only thing they can kind of do is, like Bret says in that last line, like, the Hitman character was murdered, but Bret Hart's fine. Now, whether that is the case is very much up for debate, and obviously it's something that impacted heavily and weighed on him heavily for an extremely long time, but I don't know how else you end it.
I wouldn't have included the midget footage.
I think it's there just to show that they didn't conduct themselves, they being the WWF, didn't conduct themselves kind of with any dignity following the incident. Like, they didn't try and downplay their involvement or anything like that. And I guess it's there to show as well, although it's not implied in the film because Sean's kind of a minor character, that he was a liar. Like, and I think in Bret's book he says, you know, he even told Sean, like, I'll judge you by, you know, what you do going forward from this. And Bret watching that on TV shows, yeah, you were in on it. You lied to my face, but you definitely knew about it.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a tricky one too, and I think it needed a quick wrap-up because there's not many places you could take it without turning it into a three-hour documentary.
Exactly.
So I guess that was the best way of doing it. The hitman's dead, but Bret Hart's all right. I quite like that as a sentiment as he comes out.
What character does Bret have when he goes to WCW?
Bret the Hitman Hart.
So the hitman isn't dead?
No.
The hitman's all right. He has a feud with Goldberg.
The hitman's heavily wounded. But, yeah, just kind of, what about the imagery of him kind of walking? Because that shot must have been chosen for a reason, but I couldn't work out what it was.
I guess it's to show that although he'd lost that one fatherly figure, he still has the other one.
Mm.
Good, yeah.
The one who, you know, he even says it early on in the documentary, like, he always felt like he was trying to please Vince, but really it was to please his father.
Yeah.
And although this one of them betrayed him, like, he still has his actual father and this person to look up to in the world.
Good. Oh, no, I like that. That makes a lot more sense now.
That's what I'm here for.
You're good at explaining stuff like that. I kind of need you while I'm watching stuff, Stuart. You've got to come around while I'm watching stuff like this.
Thoughts on the film overall, then?
I really enjoyed it. Actually, I think, like I said, my favourite parts of it were, weirdly enough, not actually anything to do with the main plot line. Mainly because I feel like, you know, we've been heavily invested in hearing lots about this. So the real interest for me was seeing some of the more backstage stuff about how things operate behind the scenes and what the wrestlers are like. And, you know, aside from these characters, how they behave. So I thought that was really good. But as a narrative that follows, it makes perfect sense. And I get what that bit that we saw with the director, where he said it was kind of how fortunate that this happened, because, you know, you start off doing this, it's a year in the life of Bret Hart, you come into the end of it, and actually it's just been quite flat, but suddenly you've got this wonderful ending that makes it into a very exciting thing. And so I get where he comes from with that, where he says that some people think that it's a bit too fortunate that happened, but I guess it was just fortunate that that happened. And so it actually turns out as a 90-minute piece to be really good. I think it could have easily been longer.
Yeah.
I think that they were sticking to a 90-minute runtime where actually, I mean, like, we're fans, so I would have quite happily watched a two-and-a-half-hour version of this that had more detail in it. But I guess you've got to produce it for a market that is not necessarily a wrestling fan. And this is untested at the time, and they don't know how monumentous this screw job's going to be, so they don't know how well it's going to be looked at. So they've got to keep it to a reasonable timing for it. But yeah, very, very interesting. It definitely just shown, obviously, completely from the side of Bret, but you're always going to get that with whatever documentary. You can't make an unmediated and unopinionated documentary.
Well, I think one of the first essays, Adam, when you and I first did media studies, when we were like 14, 15, or was it even film studies at A-level, it was, is documentary filmmaking a window on the world?
Yeah.
No, that's Total Divas.
But it is, but it's shown from someone's perspective.
Yeah, and just sorry, Paul, just before kind of you give your thoughts on it, do you think as a film it would appeal to non-wrestling fans? Because there are some themes there that kind of transcend wrestling in terms of honour, betrayal, good, evil, the themes about fatherhood, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think there is a place there where some people that aren't necessarily wrestling fans would find this an interesting watch. But I definitely think it has probably 10 times the value to people who are fans of the business.
Yeah, I think it's a slightly weird one to think about who's likely to watch it, because if I wasn't a wrestling fan, I wouldn't seek out a wrestling documentary.
No, but if it was the sort of thing that kind of you were flipping through channels one evening and it was on, do you think the themes there and the topics being discussed would appeal enough to you to kind of continue watching it?
Possibly, but in terms of sales and the point of a documentary, it doesn't quite seem right that you'd do it based on that, because you're doing it to make money, aren't you?
But again, documentaries don't necessarily just have to appeal to the fans of what they're about. You know, look at something like, you've probably never seen it, kind of Hoop Dreams, like
basketball.
Yeah.
Like, so I really enjoyed that film, but I don't know dick all about basketball. But it's not about basketball. It's about basketball or people that play basketball, but their lives.
I thought that was good. A crisp documentary.
Hula Hoop Dreams.
Or something like When We Were Kings.
Yeah, so about boxing, and I'm not necessarily a boxing fan, but that's amazing because it's all about, I mean, it's kind of about politics and character work in the boxing industry, and it's really, really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I'd agree with Adam. Say, I would think that I'd have enjoyed it a little bit more if it was a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very interesting, but I kind of had the feeling that I wanted to see more of this backstage stuff. And maybe there was good reasons that I didn't see certain things that I was looking for. Like, I was expecting to see a lot more of stuff with Shawn Michaels. Like, I was hoping for a bit of squirrel incident or that kind of thing. You know, just to see some of that, because that's some really interesting, and it's a really important part of your life, because Brett seemingly is consumed with this kind of ongoing, you know, dispute and kind of hatred for Shawn Michaels, yet you get so little of that.
Yeah.
And that seems like a very prominent part of this year is having.
But so like we say, it's just there's just not enough time to kind of incorporate Shawn as a major character.
Perhaps not, but it's something that is kind of somebody that's interested in this kind of, you know, story and where it's going. I felt that I missed out a bit on that side of things.
Does any of the footage here change how you feel about the Montreal incident or any of its major players?
Julie.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's like, honestly, she comes across as an absolute legend.
Yeah, Blade. But I don't think it changes my opinion of anything, because what we did on the last episode went into every single detail about it. Okay, so it didn't, like, watching this after that didn't change my opinion of anything that happens. And plus, I know that this is from one viewpoint, and so I watch it more as an interest and an entertainment rather than to give me a wealth of new opinions and ideas about the subject that I feel like I know pretty well now, actually.
It'd been interesting to have had, like, an equivalent Shawn Michaels documentary following his year. Do you think, genuinely?
I think I was saying that actually Vince really should have made his own own documentary.
Like, he
He's got loads of footage. He'd be able to, and instead of doing this, like, dick interview on Raw where he just comes across really badly, actually to have made a... Because you could construct a documentary quite easily that painted Brett as the villain.
Well,
I'm really surprised he didn't do that. That's a much more sophisticated way of putting your side across.
Well, in the shows, kind of the weekend after Survivor Series, they did kind of run these short segments narrated by Jim Ross that were designed to lead to build to the interviews with Vince, just called Why Brett Why, The Untold Story. There was nothing particularly revelatory or fascinating in there, but, you know, in a very smallest of ways, they did kind of do that, and we'll discuss when they considered doing that, you know, shortly. I think it's a fascinating documentary. You know, obviously I'm bound to like it because I'm a big Brett fan. But yeah, like I said, this is the most infamous, notorious incident in wrestling history. And it just so happens that one of the three major characters in it happened to have a film crew following him for a year.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Like, stuff like the conversation with Vince, the brief conversation with Shawn in the locker room, and Julie Hart talking to Triple H outside the locker room are absolutely fascinating, and some of the most interesting footage I think we've seen in terms of, you know, what we watch is the television product.
Yeah.
You know, outside of a few documentaries, we've not really covered anything else, but, like, God, how fascinating is it to see Triple H stood outside that locker room with his head hung down while Julie dresses him down? Like, that's incredible.
Did you say you first saw this in the late 90s, was it?
Yeah, it was on BBC Two. I definitely remember watching it, like, one night on television.
Well, and it only took us, like...
20 years.
20 years
to watch it.
To get around to it, yeah.
If you've not seen it, it's definitely worth watching. And like I say, you can watch it on YouTube, or it is available on the Canadian Film Board's website. So it's free and easy to access. You don't have to go and kind of hunt down a copy of the DVD or anything. Mm. But I think it provided us with a nice conclusion to this arc we've been covering for the better part of, well, kind of the arc itself, four episodes, you know, beginning with Survivor Series 92, the two parts we did of Survivor Series, and now this, it kind of gives us that last little perspective on it, I think.
Yeah, and very, very unique, like you say, in terms of any type of incident or angle or storyline that follows through in the business, whether it be real or fake, to have a documentary made alongside it.
I mean, you think of other moments in wrestling where you think, well, I wish there was a camera there. So you perhaps even point to 6 months after this, you know, say someone had approached Shawn and done, okay, we're gonna clean you up. We're going to paint you as the good guy. We're going to do a documentary about you. And you could have filmed, say, Undertaker telling him before WrestleMania 14 and he goes out, you know, you go out there and lose or I'm going to kill you. Like, yeah. There are other moments like that that you must think, wow, it would have been fascinating if you could have been a fly on the wall in that conversation or something like that. So, yeah, there's nothing really else, I don't think, comparable to it. Obviously, Beyond the Mat is regarded as kind of one of, if not the best wrestling documentaries, but I definitely think this stands up to it.
Wait, how would you say this compares to Beyond the Mat?
I don't really know how to compare the two. I think although they're both about wrestling and wrestlers, they're almost completely different.
I mean, it's been a long time since... Have you seen Beyond the Mat, Adam?
Yeah.
It's been a long, long time since I've seen it. It's perhaps, maybe 10 years. Yeah, maybe longer than that.
It's been a while since I've watched it. Yeah.
But my memory of it is, and it might not be right, that it felt a bit less focused than this does.
It definitely draws on more stories. So you've got, Terry Funk, Jake Roberts, Mick Foley. You've got the kind of the comedy Dennis Stamp stuff inserted. You've got Donovan Morgan and I struggle to remember the other guy's name, Tony something, where they're kind of showing them as young guys trying to get into the WWF. Mm. You have Droz and the infamous scene with Vince. So not that it's unfocused, but just it tries to show more of a collective piece about a bunch of different people in the industry and the different levels they're at, whereas this is obviously very clearly focused on one man and where he is. Anything else you want to just say about the film to close?
Other than well worth a look. No, not really.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I'd definitely recommend watching it. There's definitely some very interesting moments in there.
There's a worse way to spend an hour and a half.
I don't want to get too heavily into how Bret Hart enters WCW, as we'll discuss that in a couple of episodes' time when we get to Starrcade 1997, but this still feels like the right time to deliver our goodbye to Bret. Even Hart himself would admit that his WCW run is not a patch on his WWF career for a variety of reasons. Perhaps mostly, Montreal hangs heavily over his head, and he is never quite the same wrestler that he was before that occurred. Bret's high points in WCW were extremely few and far between. His first WCW bout with Ric Flair at Sold Out on January 24th, 1998 is decent. His infamous Who Are You to Doubt El Dandy promo and an angle with Bill Goldberg on the March 29th, 1999 episode of Nitro where he challenged Goldberg to spear him only to reveal he was wearing a metal breastplate are some of the early ones that kind of spring to mind. The Hitman would be further rocked by the untimely death of his brother Owen on May 23rd, 1999, and would take a further 4 months away from the promotion following his recovery from a groin injury. Bret would contest perhaps his best match in WCW with Chris Benoit on the 4th of October 1999 episode of Nitro, held in the Kemper Arena where Owen had died months earlier. Never truly ascending to main event status in WCW, perhaps due to the murky political waters that he wasn't prepared to swim in, Bret the Hitman Hart would capture the WCW title twice, technically, when some of the sharks were absent. Firstly, he defeated Chris Benoit in the finals of a tournament to win the strap at Mayhem on November 21st, 1999. He would vacate the title less than a month later due to a controversial match ending against Goldberg at Starrcade on December 19th. The controversial ending?
Is it a screw job?
A recreation of the Montreal screw job, with Roddy Piper as referee claiming that Goldberg gave up whilst in the sharpshooter. Bret would reclaim the title later in the evening in another bout with Goldberg, where he turned heel and joined at the New World Order, comprised of himself, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash and Jeff Jarrett. Unfortunately, during the Starrcade bout, an errant mule kick from Goldberg would give Bret a concussion, forcing the Hitman to relinquish the WCW title for a second time on January 16th, 2000, and retire permanently from professional wrestling.
Wow.
After his career ended, Bret divorced from his wife Julie on June 24th, 2002, mere hours before he suffered a stroke after hitting his head in a bike accident. The Calgary Herald reported that Hart hit a pothole, flew over the handlebars of the bike and landed on the back of his head. Hart suffered total paralysis on his left side, which required months of physical therapy to regain mobility. I also feel like we should mention the deaths of both Stu and Helen Hart. Helen died on November 4th, 2001, aged 76, following complications from a stroke. Helen had initially gone into hospital in late September and had spent a number of weeks in a coma. In his book, Bret says that Helen died with Stu holding her hand. In May 2003, Stu had a life-threatening bout of pneumonia, which saw him hospitalised at Rocky View General Hospital in Calgary. However, he recovered later that month and returned home. Stu was readmitted to the hospital on October 3rd, 2003, as a result of an elbow infection before developing pneumonia. Stu then suffered a stroke on October 15th and died a day later on October 16th, aged 88, with Brett at his side. There's a quite affecting passage about Stu's death and his funeral in Brett's book, but that's not something I'm going to read here. In mid-2005, when Brett got wind that the WWF was about to release a DVD on his career entitled Screwed, The Bret Hart Story, Brett would become involved with the promotion for the first time in nearly 8 years. Sensing the piece would end up similar to the self-destruction of the Ultimate Warrior, Hart allowed himself to be interviewed for the documentary portion of the set that ended up titled Brett the Hitman Hart, The Best There Is, The Best There Was, and The Best There Ever Will Be, and is one of the best DVD sets the WWF ever produced. The feature even opened with Vince McMahon thanking Brett for his contributions to the company and for his understanding in putting the piece together. The documentary was a joint production of the WWE and Brett Hart, Vince tells the audience. On April 1st, 2006, Brett the Hitman Hart was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame by Stone Cold Steve Austin, the headliner of that year's class, under the provision that Shawn Michaels did not attend the event. He neglected to appear alongside his fellow inductees at WrestleMania 22 the following night, presumably being as Michaels would definitely be in the building. On the June 11th, 2007 Raw, Hart made his first appearance since October 27th, 1997, when he appeared in a pre-taped interview voicing his opinions on Vince McMahon as part of Mr. McMahon Appreciation Night. Bret Hart's autobiography, which we've used heavily throughout the duration of the show, Hitman, My Real Life in the Cartoon World of Wrestling, was released on October 16, 2007. Hart, alongside his friend Marcy Engelstein, had begun writing the book in 1999. However, due to the various tragedies that Bret endured in his life, it took 8 years to complete. The first time I ever met Bret the Hitman Hart was at a book signing at Forbidden Planet in London in 2008 that Adam came along for. We queued for hours and, in fact, didn't even make it inside the building before the time the signing was scheduled to end. Luckily for me and many others, he stuck around for a number of hours afterwards to continue signing copies of the book.
It was a long day. I'm glad it wasn't all in vain.
In case anyone is interested, I've met Bret a further two times. Once before Revolution Pro Wrestling's Uprising 2013 on the 19th of October, just before we launched this show. It was a pre-show meet and greet, and I was actually the last person in the queue, so it was very much signature photo and done. The last time was a year or so later on November 8th, 2014, when he did an evening with at the King Power Stadium, and we all got a chance to meet him. Being fairly low in the media rankings, we didn't get a chance to interview the Hitman in the time allotted, but sitting in a room with no more than 10 people listening to him tell stories was something I'll never forget. He did make time for us later in the evening when he was signing autographs away from the bulk of the audience, and I compiled his answers for a piece that was published in Calling Spots magazine. He also gave us the immortal Bruce was the shits line that we'll forever love him for.
So yeah, it seems like, I mean, I've only met him twice, but both times he's made extra effort to make sure that everyone that turns up to see him, for whatever reason, gets that chance, which is actually, you know, I say speaks very, very well of the bloke.
Well, I've only met him once, but he comes across as a true star in that I think a true star knows how to treat the fans and they know what's really behind their success. Because for anybody, no matter how good you are, whatever you excel in, if you haven't got any fans or supporters, it makes, you know, you're not a star. He was very generous with his time. He answered everybody's questions in great detail, told great stories, had a lovely kind of sense of humour, kind of like quite, I think you used the term at the time, like he was self-deprecating and self-aggrandising.
Yeah.
At the same time, but in a lovely way, not in a kind of, in an arrogant way. So yeah, no, I've really kind of enjoyed that experience, even though I was only kind of starting to appreciate him, because I was relatively near the start of our run, really.
Yeah, it was just inside the first year, yeah. Bret the Hitman Hart returned to Monday Night Raw for the first time in 13 years on January the 4th, 2010, when he appeared as the guest host of the show. Hart's show opening segment would be interrupted by the Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels. After briefly rehashing the events of Montreal, the two men shook hands and embraced, something they both claim was legitimate and not part of a storyline. Hart would also seemingly bury the hatchet with WWE owner Vince McMahon later in the evening until McMahon kicked him in the balls. This would lead to the infamously bad Bret Hart versus Vince McMahon match at WrestleMania 26 on March 28, 2010, ironically the night his longtime rival Michaels retired following a loss to The Undertaker. The match housed a confusing angle where supposedly Vince had paid off Bret's family to side with him, but instead they told Bret about it and sided with Bret. In case you wondered or don't remember, yes, Bruce was involved in this match.
Was he?
He was the special referee.
Really?
Right, I'm going to go back and watch that. You've got it, right?
Well, yeah, and it's on the network anyway.
Excellent. We should totally watch that for a bonus episode.
Yes, you're right, we should. Brett would then have a short stint as the general manager of Raw and would actually capture the US title from The Miz on the 17th of May episode, although he would soon relinquish the strap. The Hitman would also form part of Team WWE alongside John Cena, Edge, Chris Jericho, R-Truth, John Morrison and the returning Daniel Bryan to take on Wade Barrett's Nexus at SummerSlam on August 15th, 2010.
I'm sure I must have seen this, but...
He didn't wrestle in that, did he?
Well, he had a brief in-ring exchange that saw him place Heath Slater in the sharpshooter and was then disqualified for hitting Skip Sheffield with a chair.
Okay, sounds good.
In an obviously limited in-ring capacity, Hart would compete in the WWE's Tour of Germany in November 2010 alongside the Hart dynasty of D.H. Smith and Tyson Kidd, taking on various combinations from the Nexus. Hart's last bout listed on Cage Match is from the 12th of September 2011 episode of Raw, where he teamed with John Cena to defeat the duo of Alberto Del Rio and Ricardo Rodriguez. Hart has made sporadic appearances for the company since then, often with his niece Natalia, most notably appearing in her corner for her bout for the vacant NXT Women's title with Charlotte, who had her father Ric Flair in her corner at the original NXT TakeOver on May 29th, 2014. In addition to the DVD documentary I mentioned earlier, a number of WWE sets related to Brett have been released. On April 6, 2010, the WWE brought out a set entitled Heart and Soul, the Heart Family Anthology, which chronicled the various members of the legendary Canadian family and finally brought to light the Bret and Owen Hart against the Steiner Brothers match that was somewhat of a holy grail. In November 2011, the WWE produced a set entitled Greatest Rivalries, Bret vs. Shawn, a set which featured a sit-down interview with the pair and Jim Ross, as well as numerous bouts between the two, including their ladder match and some Hart Foundation vs. Rockers contests. Finally, on March 5th, 2013, Bret Hart The Dungeon Collection was released on DVD and Blu-ray, which contained a number of less famous Bret Hart matches alongside the Hitman offering his thoughts on them. If you're a fan of Brett, all of these sets are worth picking up, and the Heart and Soul and Dungeon Collection sets both contain matches that aren't available on the WWE Network as of this recording. Ooh. On February 1st, 2016, Brett the Hitman Hart announced via a Facebook post that he was suffering from prostate cancer. Thankfully, a couple of months later, on March 2nd, announcer Jim Ross would reveal that Hart was now cancer-free, a statement that Brett himself backed up later on in the year.
Good.
That was really interesting to see all the bits that he's been involved with the company since he kind of, you know, patched things up and came back.
More than I thought.
Yeah, and he's been involved in some truly bizarre things. Like, he's been in a multi-tag match against the Nexus and got disqualified for hitting Ryback with a chair. That's weird. Like, really weird.
I guess it's one of those things that, you know, time heals all wounds except for Jeff Jarrett.
And nails, probably.
And nails, yeah. Sorry, forgot nails.
It is nice that, and I take it we do believe that it is all genuine now. He's on good terms with Vince. He's happy that Shawn's found God. They're all right with each other now.
Well, we saw them sit down and kind of tell stories alongside each other a couple of years ago at WrestleCon.
And it's not just done for, it's still something to do and it brings in a paycheck or whatever. They have actually genuinely kind of made it, which is quite nice. So for something... So, on a caustic, really, and
bitter
and horrible, they've actually managed to patch things up.
Yeah, what did you make to the Q&A that they did in terms of how you felt they got on?
Yeah, I mean, they came across that they got on, but, and I think we said this before at the time, like, Brett's stories were a lot more detailed than Shawn's because, as we kind of have gathered, Brett kept meticulous notes and Shawn doesn't remember anything. The obvious highlight was Jacques Rougeau claiming that it was him, Shawn and Brett that were at the forefront of changing wrestling.
Mainly him.
But
absolutely amazing. And I was really impressed with both Brett and Shawn there for not calling him out on that. And
that you kind of wish they had.
I kind of wish
they had, yeah.
Sit down, Rougeau.
What are you on about? Yeah. You're bonkers, mate. So... Because I would very much like for us to end this episode and Brett the Hitman Hart's contributions to our show in general on a positive note, last episode you guys asked me to come up with my top 10 Brett Hart matches, so I have.
All right, let's hear them.
I placed a couple of restrictions on myself in doing this, okay? So I decided to only look within our specified timeline. So that means bouts like Shawn Michaels at Survivor Series 92, Mr. Perfect at SummerSlam 91, The Bulldog at SummerSlam 92, and Roddy Piper at WrestleMania 8 are all excluded because they're before King of the Ring 93.
Okay.
Secondly, I excluded the 10-man tag team match from Canadian Stampede, as that would probably rank pretty highly on the list for me, but it's not predominantly a Bret Hart match. There's a lot of other things going on. So, counting down, here are the 10 matches I have ranked as the Hitman's best.
Number 10.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus Mr. Perfect, King of the Ring, 13th of June, 1993. I've included this as I believe it to be the first great match we saw on the show. And if I remember correctly, Paul, it actually changed your expectations in terms of what type and quality of wrestling you thought we might see in our timeline.
Yeah, I think it was, if memory serves, it was a bit more kind of, there were some bigger spots, some bigger bumps than I thought we were likely to see.
And just a bit more action, I think, as well.
Yeah.
It was a very different dynamic than their bout at SummerSlam 91, and also has the fun promo with Mean Gene Okerlund beforehand. My dad could beat up your dad.
Hmm.
Yep. It contributed, I believe, as well, towards setting up Bret as one of the aces of our show. He wrestled three different opponents in three very different matches on the night. So he went one with Razor, one with Perfect, and one with Bam Bam. Three really different types of wrestlers. And he had good matches with all three of them. But I think the Perfect one is probably the pick of the bunch out of those three.
Hmm. Number 9.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus Diesel, Survivor Series, 19th of November, 1995.
Is that the one with that cool table spot?
It is. It had a level of aggression in it that wasn't really present in Diesel's title reign prior to this and was easily the highlight of his year-long grip on the strap. And yes, I'm including his bout with Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 11. The ending is a classic and speaks to the depth of strategy and resourcefulness of the Hitman character. He's taken a beating for some time from the 7-foot champion and suckers him into a moment of sympathy before cradling him for the three count. The fact it generated the most interesting portion of Kevin Nash's WWF career is a kind of a side benefit. He went on and did that kind of tweener thing before he eventually turned on Taker and Shawn. Mm. But yeah, like, it was a genuinely exciting match, something that, you know, Diesel's title reign really lacked.
Yeah.
Really?
Have you forgotten that year? I could fully believe it if you had.
I think the problem for me is I have forgotten almost all of Diesel's matches. And the only ones that really stick in my mind is this Bret Hart one and the Shawn Michaels one, because they're memorable, and the rest of them were just kind of dull.
The Mabel one?
Yeah, do you remember when Mabel sat on his back and crushed his spine?
Memorable, but for the wrong reasons.
Number 8.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus Jean-Pierre Lafitte in Your House 3, 24th of September 1995. I could just as easily put Bret's match with Hakushi in this slot, but either would make the list to demonstrate another in-ring strength I feel Bret had, making matches that weren't necessarily designed to feel important exciting. The feud began under the pretty abysmal premise that Lafitte had stolen Bret's trademark jacket and Bret was upset about this. Yes, you'd probably be pissed off, but you'd just go and buy another one, surely. Anyway, as with Hakushi, Bret took an undercard guy with a solid amount of talent and made them feel on his level. Should Lafitte have been beating Bret? Probably not. But that doesn't mean that Bret can't make you feel for moments every now and again like he might. With Diesel and Shawn Michaels occupying the main event slot throughout 1995, Bret took up the role of the champion of the mid-card and produced crackers like this that presumably only made people wonder why he wasn't in the main event.
It was a good match.
Yeah, I remember really enjoying that. A big fan of the Pirate.
Yeah, good wrestler for a one-eyed guy.
Number 7.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus the British Bulldog, In Your House 5, 17th of December 1995. As I mentioned earlier, their most famous match occurred outside of our timeline, but I think even if I had included that match on this list, this bout would have probably still found its way into the top 10 also. A completely different dynamic than their SummerSlam 1992 bout, in this one, Davey Boy Smith is the clear-cut heel, and the two have an absolute war that is accentuated by the presence of blood. You can debate all day as to the purpose, benefit and necessity of bleeding in wrestling, but you can't deny that in the right context it adds drama to a story, and its surprise appearance here, no less the amount Bret bled, cranked up the gravitas unlike any title match we'd seen before it. Bret's third title reign is slightly marred by the fact it was clearly a placeholder run until Shawn beat him for the strap at WrestleMania 12, but it has a very clear highlight, and this is it.
I really enjoyed that match. You're right, the blood did add drama. Number 6.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus Bob Backlund.
Interesting choice.
from WWF Superstars, 30th of July, 1994. Yes, their match at WrestleMania 11 was a total dud, in part ruined by Roddy Piper's turn as an invasive special guest referee, and yes, their bout at Survivor Series 1994 went on for what felt like forever, but the bout that kicked off the Bret Hart-Bob Backlund series was great, and not just compared to the ones that followed. This is genuinely a good match. Its brilliance accentuated by the fact that Bob Backlund had been totally relevant for 2 years. He'd been back in the WWF, and it kicked off the Mr. Bob Backlund that we all loved so much.
Hmm.
Backlund was a very different opponent than Bret usually faced, and in fact, a lot of the WWF roster at the time struggled to have a good match with him. Seriously, name me one good Bob Backlund match from the 1990s run that isn't this one. This match was legitimately one of the reasons I had us do the free-for-all best TV matches of 1994 episode, because I just wanted to cover this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Number five.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus the 1-2-3 Kid, Monday Night Raw, 11th of July 1994. Speaking of which, this was the other reason I had us do that episode. Outside of perhaps Randy Savage, I cannot imagine any other WWF champion prior to Bret Hart having this kind of match with a wrestler the stature and physique of the 1-2-3 Kid. As with the Lafitte match earlier, I don't think anyone really felt like the Kid would be beating Bret Hart, especially for the WWF title, but Bret did absolutely everything he possibly could to make you feel like he might. A strong contender for Sean Waltman's best match ever, and he's a guy who had matches for a number of high-profile companies over a 15-year or so period. Worth noting as well is the commentary team of Jim Ross and Macho Man Randy Savage, who are absolutely superb in this match, Savage in particular singing the praises of the Kid's performance, and it's often a match that still turns up when they do like top 10 or top 20 Raw matches of all time. This really is the one match from that era that always makes those lists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a cracker. Short,
yeah,
but really good.
Number four.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus Owen Hart, SummerSlam, 29th of August, 1994. A strong contender for the most unique cage match of all time that didn't feature a ton of silly additions or gimmicks, and the first match on our list today to receive the famous five stars, and was in fact only the second WWF match to do so after Shawn Michaels versus Razor Ramon at WrestleMania 10 months earlier. Traditionally, cage matches were bloody feud settlers that upped the violence level on a dispute. This was smack bang in the middle of a pretty intense feud, but showed that you didn't need blood to make a cage match memorable. Right from the start, both men do their absolute best to escape the cage as quickly as they can, which can often be a major logic flaw in this type of match. This was the closest Owen Hart ever came to winning the WWF title, and I remember as a kid thinking that, well, as Owen had beaten Bret at WrestleMania, he could beat him at SummerSlam. It's also an absolute crime that this was not the main event of the show, sadly going on before the diabolical Undertaker versus Undertaker match, which, Adam, you and I recently discovered that the WWE ranks in its top 20 Undertaker moments.
Which is so wrong, I can't even really verbalise it.
Yeah, like, have they watched it recently? But yeah, absolutely stunning cage match that's not really like any other one.
Mm. There's the superplex off the top, isn't there? That's insane. Number three.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus Stone Cold Steve Austin, Survivor Series, 17th of November, 1996.
Interesting.
Well, I bet you thought this would be number one, right?
Yes, I did, yes. Seeing as you banged on about it for a long time.
Yeah, I thought you'd swerve this one.
Lists like this are difficult to do, especially when you're trying to separate best from favourite.
Okay.
If we're talking favourite, then this would be a strong contender for number one, but as we're doing best, I don't feel I can place it any higher than three. Regardless of that, it's a classic on one of my all-time favourite pay-per-views. Bret was just returning from a six-month absence to allow Shawn Michaels his moment in the spotlight, and he couldn't have picked a better opponent, rising heel Stone Cold Steve Austin. The pre-match promo is also one of my absolute favourites and contains perhaps the best promo line Bret ever delivered. Madison Square Garden, it's not a church, but it is holy ground. So completely different from their other match, this is a wrestling match rather than a brawl that takes Austin, who had actually done very little since winning King of the Ring earlier in the year, and brings him to Bret's level. Unlike some of the others we mentioned earlier in the list, where we mentioned Bret did that for them, but they weren't perhaps at his level, Austin absolutely belonged on the same plateau as Bret and shows it in this bout. In the end, Bret shows the cocky, vicious heel that he has one more trick in his book than Austin had and picks up the win, but Austin loses absolutely nothing in defeat.
Hmm. That's really, it's a very good match.
So we've got two left.
I can think of three matches that I would expect you to put in these two slots.
Okay.
WrestleMania 10.
Yeah, WrestleMania 10.
Owen.
WrestleMania 13. WrestleMania 12. So what misses out? Number two.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus Stone Cold Steve Austin, WrestleMania 13, 20th of March, 1997. In completing this list, I had a bit of a browse online, and the majority of lists where people rank best ever Bret Hart matches, this comes top, and I completely understand why. In the documentary we've just watched, Bret talks about wrestling being an art, and there being an art telling a story, and perhaps nothing bell to bell exemplifies this more than this match. We've said it before, and it's absolutely true, that Steve Austin would have been a star with or without Bret Hart, but having a match of this calibre certainly doesn't hurt. It had been building for months, since Bret Hart's return, in fact, that crowds were responding more and more to the renegade, no-fucks-given heel Steve Austin, and that the Bret Hart character had a legitimate gripe with that. What had he done to deserve this treatment from the fans? In this match, for really the first time, the Bret Hart character sinks to Stone Cold's level and goes to absolute war. Completely different from their Survivor Series 1996 match, this is an out-and-out brawl between two characters diametrically opposed that hate each other. And what can you say about the finish? Perhaps for the right reasons, the most memorable end to a match ever. Bret Hart gets Steve Austin in the sharpshooter, and despite the fountain of blood gushing from his head, Austin won't give up, instead passing out from the pain, forcing guest referee Ken Shamrock, who does a much better job than Rowdy Roddy Piper 2 years earlier, by the way, is forced to stop the match. After the bell, Bret cements his villainous status with a cowardly attack on the defeated Austin, and Austin, like a classic good guy, refuses help to get himself to the back. WrestleMania 13 isn't particularly fondly remembered in general, so it's hard to imagine what people would think of that show without this on the card.
Mm-hmm.
Again, when the WWE or anyone in general does best WrestleMania matches ever, if not number one, this is usually top three.
Yeah.
And if you're talking best WWF match ever, there's a strong contender for, if not number one, top three, top five.
Yeah.
Have you worked out what number one is then?
Well, I'm hoping you're going to go WrestleMania 10, but I've got an awkward feeling you might go for 12. Number one.
Bret the Hitman Hart versus Owen Hart.
Oh, thank goodness.
WrestleMania 10, 20th of March, 1994. WrestleMania 10, compared to WrestleMania 13, however, is fondly remembered, and a big part of it is this match, which probably still stands today as the greatest opening match of all time. The storyline is a simple one, but an all-time classic that I struggle to think of a single wrestling fan that I've ever spoken to doesn't enjoy. Owen is the younger brother who struggles in his elder sibling's spotlight and eventually snaps and wants the attention for himself. Bret initially refuses to fight Owen, but reluctantly gives in and agrees to the match, hoping it will solve their differences. They wrestle a technical masterpiece with Bret the begrudging participant and Owen the irritating antagonist, goading Bret into engaging with him. The finish is also a classic and crops up throughout Bret's career as somewhat of an Achilles heel. Owen sits down on a Bret roll-up and gets the hugely surprising pinfall, the Rocket himself even shocked by his victory. It also sets up perfectly the storyline coming out of Bret's title win later in the evening. After Bret wrests the WWF title away from Yokozuna in the main event, the WWF's babyface locker room empties to celebrate with him and hoist him up on their shoulders. And then Owen appears in the aisleway, glaring at his older brother, at once angry that Bret has once again captured the WWF title, but also armed with the knowledge that he can beat him. And the audience knows this also, given events earlier in the evening. Curiously, while doing a final tidy-up of my notes before we recorded, I spotted this is the only match on the list where Bret loses, and it's number one.
Wow.
Mm. While you may not feel that this is the best Bret Hart match ever, or even the best WrestleMania match ever, if you're making a top 10 list of either and this doesn't appear, your list is wrong. It's a match I never tire of going back and watching, and if you've not watched it in a while, go and look it up, because it's a classic.
Yeah. So let's ask, why was 12 not included then?
I could think of 10 better matches. Like, I'm higher on that match than I think a lot of people are. Like, I don't hate it or find it deathly dull in the way a lot of fans do. But I don't know, I just felt those 10 were more exciting. I had a list of kind of, I think, 18 to 20 in the end, and I couldn't put that match on it.
Mm-hmm.
There were just better ones to talk about.
Were you kind of thinking at all about putting Survivor Series 97 on there?
No, I don't think that ever even made my list, if I'm honest. It's a good match, but it's too heavily weighted by the ending.
Well, I mean, in terms of, because, you know, it's definitely not the best match, but in terms of significance, and I know you're kind of going perhaps with a slight different list, but it's a very significant
match. Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about most memorable Bret Hart matches, it would be number one.
Mm.
But yeah, in terms of best, like I say, convincing brawl beforehand, good action in the ring after the bell, but It's essential that you see it because of what happens at the end, but for me, it's not a top 10 in the matches we've seen in the last 3.5 years when we've watched Bret Hart. I mean, an honourable mention as well for that Steiner's tag. Yeah. I think I kind of shied away from tag team matches. Like I said, I did keep out the Canadian Stampede 10-man tag on purpose, and I probably could have included the Steiner's tag, but I don't know. I just kind of went with 10 singles matches.
And the one with the Knights.
Yeah, I didn't really want to include the one with the Knights. That was a bit rubbish. You could include the Jerry Lawler doink stuff at SummerSlam 1993 because that was pretty entertaining.
Some of the, that's it again, different word, isn't it? Entertaining. Lots of the Lawler stuff was entertaining.
Yes.
But I don't know, you know, it's a 3.5 year period we've kind of covered Bret Hart matches, and to have kind of, like I say, 18 to 20 that you could put on a list is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
There's not too many wrestlers that you could do that with.
He has been, you know, perhaps the most consistent person that we've had, because he's been there for the entire run pretty much. I mean, he had a few absences, didn't he, when he was off being a cowboy. But generally speaking, when he's got a match on a show, we normally get something pretty good.
To be fair, Sean's been very consistent.
Yeah.
Ahmed was very consistent before his kidney.
Ahmed's been consistent in an entirely different way.
Consistently amazing.
So Bret Hart, yay or nay?
Well, do either of you want to offer an opinion on what your favourite or what you think the best Bret Hart match you've seen while we've been doing the show is? What would you pick as number one?
I'd go with you. I'd WrestleMania 10, definitely. The whole feud with Owen. I preferred that feud to the Austin feud, personally. Probably just had a better connection with it.
After we heard about, you know, the older brother situation earlier.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's all making sense now. Wrestling with Scrivens, the documentary coming soon.
Just be focused on me and my dad. Yeah, so I really enjoyed that. There's those kind of like, sort of like hidden gem ones, like kind of alluding to the one with the Quebecers and stuff like that, where the action in there is incredible. And it's like you say, it's almost taking a match that you've got no right to really care about and making it more interesting. So yeah, from that sense, that's been good. And it's been really interesting just throughout the show to know, like, I had really no knowledge of Bret. I knew he was kind of like a high profile guy, a big deal. I'd really seen, I think, none of his wrestling. And to kind of get to see what he could do and the sorts of matches he could deliver has been a really kind of interesting and exciting thing. And it was really good to get to meet him a couple of years ago.
Your pick for number one?
Hard to say. I do love the Owen one at WrestleMania 10. I do love that, the 1-2-3 kid match from Raw. And that, bizarrely enough, is one of the few matches of this period that I'd seen before we did the podcast.
Okay.
Because you sat me down and said, here, watch this. It's dead good. And it's like, well, yeah. It's from this really random, like, mid-90s part of Raw. So that really is quite amazing, considering the length of time that it goes.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. And I really enjoyed the Iron Man match as well, actually, which was one that I didn't think that I was going to like, because I thought it would just be too long. But I think that was really interesting. But I'd probably go for the one that I found purely most entertaining was probably the Bulldog match.
Okay,
it was good.
Because, and I think it is what you said, that blade job towards the end of it just switches it up several gears, and it's absolutely fantastic.
So where do you think Bret Hart sits when you're compiling a list of the best wrestlers ever? Should he be in the discussion? If so, whereabouts? And if not, why not? I said this to Adam earlier. Bret Hart's a guy, either you get people like me who, when you're talking best ever, he's there, or you think he's just scraping the top 50. Like, everyone generally agrees Flair is there or thereabouts. Everyone generally agrees Terry Funk is there or thereabouts. But Bret's a guy that either you are adamant that he's top 5 or you might put him in your top 50.
And are the arguments for Bret not being up the top, are they the fact that he has his limited moveset? That's a criticism that people often say. The 5 moves of Doom or whatever, that is his promo work generally isn't seen as being that good, even though we've seen some very good stuff in 97. So all these things, are they what people remember of Bret Hart? Does anyone consider that he was a better tag wrestler than a singles competitor? I don't know. Personally speaking, like I say, just in what we've been doing, he has been one of, if not the most consistently good person that we've seen out of such a long period of time. And yeah, he does kind of have like a limited move set, but he also has the ability to add different things in at different times, depending on which opponent he's doing. So the variation that he shows is subtle, but very, very necessary. And everything he does is very crisp. And he doesn't, he doesn't screw up any moves, which I really like Ahmed Johnson. He screws up all his moves.
Different things from different people.
Exactly. So I think in terms of wrestling technique, he's definitely got to be mentioned. I don't know whether I'd put him as greatest wrestler of all time, but if someone asked me to like grade my top 10 wrestlers, which is something I'd probably have to sit down and think and re-remember and re-watch a lot of matches, he'd probably be in the top 10 somewhere, just because I've seen very good stuff from him over a consistently long period.
It's a tricky one. Again, I think it perhaps comes down to how you word it. So are you talking about best wrestlers or are you talking about most entertaining sports entertainers?
Best
wrestlers. In terms of best wrestlers, he's got to be right up there. For my opinion, it's a bit of a different kind of character. Say somebody like The Rock, who's got perhaps a slightly different kind of aura and kind of magnetism about it, or perhaps an Austin. But kind of in-ring technical ability, there's not many that I could think to put on the same level at all or above him. I'd struggle to think of anybody.
It's an interesting one, and I think you kind of boil it down to, in fact, the story we've been telling since episode one, and I think in episode one we talked about how people have very fond memories of the Attitude Era because that was a time when a lot of people were watching, and people have very fond memories of the Hogan Era because tons of people were watching it then as well. But there's this period in the middle where less people are attached to it, but I think the people who are attached to it are more attached to it. And that's where I fall, because that's where I started watching, and Bret Hart was the guy that instantly was my favourite as a child for the entire, 3.5 years or whatever it was, I watched it as a child. And then kind of when I got back into it slightly older, like going back and finding out what happened to him, and even this reappraisal that we've done over 3.5 years hasn't lessened my love for him as a wrestler and my belief that, he's, if we're doing favourites, for me, he's number one. Brian's a close second, but Brett's number one, and I can't ever really see anyone knocking him off that spot. But yeah, if you're trying to do an objective list of greatest wrestlers ever, I think he deserves credit for the amount of good matches he had in a federation that wasn't exactly brimming with five-star talent. A lot of people when making best wrestler ever lists will look at a lot of the Japanese guys and girls and, some Mexican guys and girls and Flair and Funk and stuff. And you think they had a variety of like really good opponents to have matches with on a consistent basis. Bret carried that company at a time when it wasn't overflowing with talent. Mm. Bret carried the company at a time when they weren't drawing the houses that they drew in the Hogan era and that they would draw in the Attitude Era. And yeah, he deserves credit for being the guy that Vince could rely on to go back to when Luger failed, when Diesel failed, to get things ready for Sean, etc. Even for stepping away and letting Sean kind of have that moment to see whether he'd sink or swim. And, the last year of his career in the WWF has its flaws, but we saw some incredible stuff from the match with Austin at the Survivor Series to the match with Austin at Mania. The Fatal 4-Way at Final Four, like, we've not mentioned that. That was an absolute cracker.
Undertaker at SummerSlam.
The Canadian Stampede 10-man tag. Some of his promo work in that last year was the best of his career. But, yeah, for me, he has to be in that discussion, but I understand that there are people that don't feel that way.
Fair enough.
It'll be weird having a WWF without him. Same as, like we said, with Bulldog when we did Bulldog's Farewell. Yeah. It will feel weird him not being there for these last few months of the show, but we'll see the WWF go in a really different direction. If you've enjoyed what you've listened to today, here then are the top 5 ways you can support the show.
Number 5.
Give us a like on Facebook at facebook.com/NewGenerationProjectPodcast or a follow on Twitter at NewGenPodcast. Or on Instagram at New Gen Podcast and interact with us.
What is Instagram all about?
Pictures.
Okay, number 4.
Leave us a 5-star review and some kind words on iTunes. A number of you have done that recently, so thank you very much for that.
Thank you, number 3.
Take a look at our back catalogue that's going up one by one on botchamania.com.
Number 2.
Check out some more of the absolutely free bonus content we post regularly over at soundcloud.com/newgenpodcast, featuring matches from the WWE, NXT, Chikara, Michinoku Pro and All Japan Pro Wrestling. There's more going up all the time, including our review of WrestleMania 33, which also released today.
At numero one.
And if you don't mind giving a little something back, you can pledge to us over at patreon.com/newgenpodcast, where there are some cool rewards for the different levels of donation, and we're working on even more ways of giving thanks in the future. Adam and I have been discussing something this past week that we're looking to develop soon that I believe genuinely might be about the most unique piece of podcast merchandise ever produced. So keep an eye out for that.
Yep, keep an eye out for that.
Episode 82 will see us begin life without the Hitman and close out the WWF's pay-per-view year with their December offering, D-Generation X in your house.
Looking forward to that one.
Do you know anything about it?
I'm assuming it's quite heavily DX-centric.
Yes, that's a fair assumption.
I know nothing about it, apart from that promo video that we saw on the last pay-per-view.
Well, probably a good job, but we'll discuss that next time.
Oh, is it a bit of a stinker?
My name is Stuart Brooks. I'll say goodbye.
Adam White's goodbye.
I'm at Yes Paul Scriven. See ya.
Just seconds, one of the biggest comebacks in sports entertainment history will happen here at the world's most famous arena, Madison Square Garden. You yourself, Brett, have called Stone Cold Steve Austin the best wrestler in the World Wrestling Federation today, and you face him in seconds.
The one thing that Stone Cold Steve Austin doesn't have going for him in this match is the fact that it is Madison Square Garden. And I meant it when I said it's not a church, but it's holy ground. Well, it is. I've got my fans out here, and I've got my fans all around the world, and they've been waiting for this very moment. Now, where I stand, we're all going to find out right now. But Stone Cold, remember one thing.
I'm not greedy for money. I'm greedy for respect. And when this thing's all said and done, you will respect me.